Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from western Idaho. My AccuWindow forecast, the weather outside is atrocious, temperature about 185 degrees, I think. The solar wind tonight, 280.1 kilometers per second, and the proton count is quietly back down to 2.2. You can go out in the sun without sunscreen on today. On July 22nd, the longest solar eclipse of the 21st century will take place in Asia. Shanghai is the largest city in China with a population greater than 20 million. On Wednesday, the moon's shadow will linger over the great metropolis for nearly 6 full minutes, giving residents a stunning and lengthy view of the sun's ghostly corona. Tonight we are live on KFNX 1100 in Phoenix. They will be joining us in about 2 minutes, 50,000 watts of X Squared Radio, bringing you the very leading edge of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We're glad you're tuned in. Prepare to get squared. This weekend, 40 years after man first landed on the moon, more human beings than ever before are orbiting on a single spacecraft. In 1969, 3 men squeezed into Apollo 11's command module, a craft little bigger than a mini. Yesterday, the International Space Station, now as large as a 4-story house, yet speeding at 17,239 miles per hour, took on board the crew of the shuttle Endeavour. 12 men, 1 woman, 7 Americans, 2 Russians, 2 Canadians, 1 Japanese, and a Belgian. It passed over North America last night and will pass over the Phoenix area tonight at about 10:46. You might want to go out after the program and check it out. You won't be able to miss it. It'll be coming from the west, brighter than any planet up there. By the way, Jupiter is very bright in the southern sky. Last Sunday, the International Space Station lost its sidekick when Progress 33 re-entered Earth's atmosphere and disintegrated over the Pacific Ocean. The Russian supply ship had been accompanying the International Space Station for nearly 2 weeks, treating skywashers to double flybys. If you were out and saw the space station go over just a few minutes, maybe 1.5 minutes later, Progress 33 chased behind. Some people errantly thought it might have been a UFO following the space station because it didn't show up on heavensabove.com, but it was actually a Russian spacecraft. We want to welcome the Phoenix listeners tonight, KFNX 1100, 50,000 watts strong. We're glad you're here. We wouldn't be here without you tonight. My guest is the author of The God Theory. The world is able to communicate on a scale and in a timeliness unprecedented. The ability to get ideas and discoveries around the world seems to have loosened the collar of religion from the neck and allowed us to wander to the edge of the universe and back. One such scientist, now deeply schooled in both the dogmas of religion and mainstream science, has returned with an insight I think you will find exhilarating and thought-provoking. His name is Bernard Haish, and he's here with us tonight. We'll be back in about 45 seconds with him. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is getting ready to start. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're glad to have the listeners of KFNX 1100 in Phoenix, Arizona with us tonight. Seventh largest AM market in the country, 50,000 watts strong. My guest tonight is Bernard Haish. Welcome to the program, Bernard. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. I just got done reading a great book called The God Theory. This is a three-hour program, and we have millions of people listening right now, but the audience grows throughout the night. So I would like to begin by asking you about your personal journey. You started out studying religion, and how is it that you realized you had the propensity for astronomy?
Well, I knew ever since I was a little kid, since I was not even in grade school, that there were two things that really fascinated me, two things I wanted to involve myself in for the rest of my life. One was astronomy, and one was the Catholic priesthood. I was going to become a Catholic priest and an astronomer. And in fact, that's not all that far-fetched, because there are Catholic priests that are professional astronomers. And in fact, the Vatican even operates a very modern observatory in Arizona, right next to Kitt Peak. So it's not that far-fetched a thing to do. But on the other hand, I decided when I was actually in the seminary, when I was 19 years old, a freshman in the seminary, that I really would rather live the secular life, get married, have kids, and just pursue the astronomy. So I dropped out of the studies for the priesthood, and I continued in astronomy and got my PhD in astrophysics from the University of Wisconsin and had a research career ever since.
Well, did you feel the same awe and inspiration when you look up at the stars as you did when you were studying religion?
Well, you know, interestingly, I never really put that into a religious context. I was always fascinated by the sky and took my little telescope out when I was a little freshman in college and looked at the sky and marveled at it. But I really kind of put my thoughts of religion behind me when I left the seminary. That was several decades ago. I kind of let that lie fallow for a while and pursued a career in science strictly. But now as I'm reflecting back on things, I can see that there are a lot of connections to be made, and I'm hoping that what I've talked about in the God Theory makes some connections that you wouldn't ordinarily see and presents a view of God and spirituality in a way that might even appeal to professional scientists.
I got it. You know, there's always a switch or a teacher or a television program that we can always remember back in our childhood that sort of inspires us to be what it is we turn out to be. In your book, you mentioned Buzz Corbin and Happy Caddy. That was a television program that was on way back then. That kind of flipped the switch for you and caused you to select a scientific career.
You know, it's kind of funny because I got a couple of letters just about that, interestingly enough. And it turns out I had the TV program wrong. I think it was Rocky Jones Space Ranger that spurred my imagination. And I was surprised to get a couple of letters that set me straight on that. But anyway, it was the same kind of program, sort of a one joystick does it all kind of control of a spacecraft that will get you anywhere in the universe, probably.
I like that statement, from Buzz Lightyear to infinity and beyond. You know, I'm sort of an amateur astronomer. I mean, go out at night and look at the stars, but I have immense respect for astronomers because things move so slowly that it takes at least one lifetime to gain perspective. And I'll stay up past midnight, and I love being stationed in remote, non-light polluted areas so I could just go out and look at the stars at night. I even own a Sky Scout so I can be ready for those questions from my not-so-studious friends like, what's that over there? What is it about astronomy that inspired you to tackle astrophysics?
Well, they really aren't all that different. I mean, I can call myself an astronomer or an astrophysicist, and it's really pretty much the same thing. I mean, one is a bit more concentrating on the physical processes and the mathematics. Another I think of as a bit more classical, but it's really pretty much the same profession.
So how did you start a career in astrophysics, though? I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, I'm going to go and teach, but it's another to actually get involved with the industry. Where did you start? Where did you end up?
Right. Well, I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin and, of course, had to do research for my thesis. And then I wound up with my first job as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So I spent several years there doing research, primarily funded by NASA, because NASA had satellites that had ultraviolet data that needed analysis, and we had a principal investigator who had a crew of postdocs, myself included. They were all kept very busy taking that data and analyzing every last bit out of it. After that, I went to the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands for a little stint, and finally wound up in California, where I worked at an industrial research lab that actually did astrophysics research for NASA, and that was the Lockheed Palo Alto Research Lab. So it turned out there was quite a bit of opportunity to do research, and it's even possible to make a pretty good living doing that. Again, it was primarily a NASA-funded work that I did throughout those years.
Well, we realize that the headwaters of funding for space research is the Defense Department, and hence we have all worked for them directly or indirectly, at least. When you joined the community of scientists, were you amazed that it was not the same as making scientific discoveries?
Well, making scientific discoveries of some sort is, of course, essential. You have to publish those papers, and the papers have to contain some amount of research and discovery. But, of course, you know, there are only so many fundamental discoveries to be made, and everyone hopes to do it. Now, you know, the big ones are already taken. We already know that the Earth goes around the sun, so that's not a discovery waiting to be made anymore. But we all hope that we can find something that's really important to work on. But in the meantime, we have our little projects and publish papers and give talks to our colleagues and go to conferences, and it's a pretty exciting thing to be doing. But the big discoveries are, of course, few and far between.
Well, yeah, and some of the conferences are more exciting than others, too. You joined the Society for Scientific Exploration. What is that like? What's that community like?
Well, now, that's a different sort of thing, because that is something that I did as a public service. You see, there are sort of two worlds out there. There's the world of mainstream science, which I made my career in, and which does the research that you read about in the newspapers and Time and Newsweek and so on, the recognized mainstream stuff, which is very exciting and certainly very dramatic. We've discovered all sorts of neat things like, for example, dark energy in the last 10 years. But then there are fields that are sort of at the very edge of science and sometimes slightly beyond science that are populated by people that are sometimes good researchers and sometimes people that have their own agendas or they're simply confused. But nonetheless, I think that there are topics out there that warrant exploration, whether or not they're part of mainstream science. And so as my public duty, I sort of felt that I needed to do something about that, if I believe that. And so I chose to become editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration for about a dozen years. It was interesting because at the same time, I was also one of the scientific editors of the Astrophysical Journal, which is a leading journal in that field. And so I was editing two journals simultaneously, one of them being the most prestigious mainstream journal in the field, and the other one being one that sort of was looked at a bit askance because we published on topics that are just outside of mainstream science, not with any kind of agenda to promote the topics, but to let them be looked at with a skeptical but open-minded eye.
Well, you obviously got to see a lot of papers, and you got to meet a lot of people who were doing innovative thinking. And physics, when you tell people you're involved in physics, their eyes kind of glaze over because it's a little more complicated than working in the kitchen. And physics is such a huge and legitimately intimidating science. What branch of physics fascinated you the most?
Well, astrophysics, of course. That is a branch of physics, I would say. It's very connected with astronomy. So physics as applied to the processes in the universe, to the things you find in the universe, such as flares on stars, the corona of the sun that you alluded to at the outset of the program, coronae around other stars, the analysis of data that comes from the latest NASA satellites. It's that space-oriented, astronomy-oriented research that I found the most fascinating part of physics.
Well, I like, at least at the beginning of your book and scattered throughout your book, you concentrate on the study of light. And with respect to how that, how it blends with various holy writ out there, light certainly has a lot of meaning. And you specifically talk about the creative act that started the universe. What fascinated you about that study of light?
Well, I was struck by one thing. If you go to Genesis, you find that there's an origin of the universe described, which is very mythological. It talks about the sun, the moon, the stars being created after the light happened. In other words, you have, I think, on the fourth day, the creation of the sun, the moon, and the stars, even though light happened on the first day. Now, of course, that makes no sense because we know the light comes from the sun, the moon, and the stars. So there's a clear problem there, and of course, I don't worry about that because I put no stock in it anyway as anything that has any scientific validity. But it's interesting that I ran across a book some 20 years ago called the Haggadah, which is a book that I suppose could have made it into the Bible but didn't. And in it, it talks about there being another light. Another light that's not the light from the sun, the moon, and the stars. One that sort of underlies everything and that was hidden there by God. It's a fascinating reference, and it just occurred to me that just maybe, this might be a reference to something esoteric, such as, for example, the electromagnetic quantum vacuum. So it's very speculative, but it just struck me that this answer to the question, well, how can you say that light came first before the sun, the moon, and the stars, was actually addressed in a book that came from the biblical era. Not that I want to put any emphasis on the Bible, because there's no science, as far as I can see, to be had in there. But it was a curious kind of explanation of something that seemed like an absurdity.
Well, so are we talking about light as just a classification of frequency? Some frequency began the universe, or is it actually light?
Well, in the Big Bang, I mean, I firmly believe that the Big Bang is the origin of the universe, and the Big Bang consisted of the various forces and the forces that we know today that govern the universe were all one force at the very beginning when this Big Bang happened, when in a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second, some primordially small, little, highly compact, highly dense, highly energetic thing exploded and became our universe. That's what I believe gave rise to, the universe we live in today. Now you can ask the question, well, what gave rise to that? What came prior to that? And that's really the metaphysics I try to address in the book, The God Theory.
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the things that you discover, whether you're traveling down the catacombs of the halls of records of various religions or ancient civilizations, is you discover God knows everything and we do not. There would be, I don't know, there seemed to be a level of boredom in one and a profound sense of fascination and adventure in the other. Is there a reason for this?
Could you clarify that question a bit? A reason for what?
Well, you know, in the one sense, there is God, all-knowing, this void, this individual being or intelligence or energy in the universe that knows everything. And to me, that would seem kind of boring, like, gee, there's nothing new, nothing going on, no perspective, no experience. And the other, there's us, and there's, you know, the realization that we're either a creation or a piece of that original intelligence, and one is sharing the experience through the other.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that what is happening is that there is an intelligence that precedes everything, that is the sort of the Aristotelian uncaused cause that exists. It exists in perfect tranquility and bliss and harmony and love, but is all potential, yet potential is not the same thing as experience. There's a huge difference between being able to do something and doing it. For example, dreaming up the rules of a game like Monopoly versus being able to play it. And what I think the explanation of the origin of our universe is, and of ourselves too, by the way, is that the potential of this intelligence is being exercised. This intelligence wishes to know itself, know its abilities, to turn its potential into actuality. It does so by dreaming up universes, by dreaming up places where its thoughts become laws of nature. Those laws of nature allow a universe to come into existence through, in our case, a Big Bang, allow evolution to take place in the places where life can arise, and at least on the surface of this planet, if not others. And it's that conversion of potential into experience that I think is the point of our universe and the point of the living creatures, us included, that reside in that universe, for God to experience what it's like to exercise some tiny fraction of his or its potential in this particular universe, and perhaps many others. So I think that ultimately we we are nothing other than God made manifest, along with all the other life forms in the universe being God made manifest, experiencing some of that infinite potential that otherwise would just lie fallow, would be sterile.
Well, on the one hand, we can revel in the idea that at least, you know, we have God within us, and thus our experience is important in the overall scheme of things. And at the other extreme, we might be able to say, well, then I'm insignificant because everything that I learn isn't really for me. It's for God. And so we lose our individuality. But I guess we could discuss that a little more in the third hour. I personally believe that the universe is the mathematical result of all the consciousnesses of all the sentient beings in it. Do you think there's some validity in that idea?
I would sort of turn it around the other way, because I think you need an infinite consciousness to dream it up in the first place.
Right.
And I think that consciousness then enters into the life forms in that universe. I don't see how we could have a Big Bang happening that's caused by the consciousness of the beings that are now in it, because that would involve some kind of backwards causation. I think you need some creative consciousness that provides the driving force behind it all at the outset.
Yep, I agree with that. I just kind of look at the Big Bang event as the equal sign in that equation. In the book, The God Theory, you consider the most powerful questions in the universe, I think. Let's talk about creation. Let's say there is a moment when there is no matter, and then the next moment there is matter. In your explorations, what makes up both of these moments?
You know, that's, of course, a very difficult question, because we're so used to living in a time stream. We're so used to living in time and asking, well, what came before and what came before and what came before? And I think that space and time came together with the Big Bang. It's not as if the Big Bang happened in a space-time space of its own, that there was some explosion in some pre-existing space-time. I think that space-time, together with the Big Bang, were one single event, one creation event. And so we have to now ask, what can cause something in an environment that doesn't even have space and time to be causal in? And here we're faced with a great mystery, and I think this mystery can only be addressed and solved by invoking an intelligent entity, intelligent being, an intelligent consciousness that dreamed this up, out of whose thoughts this all emerged, and how it became a rule-regulated universe in which life forms could arise and experience themselves, that happened as a result of this creative consciousness deciding to act somehow prior to space and time even existing, which we can't imagine.
Well, I guess that depends on the individual. We can try to imagine, and that's kind of fun, too. So according to your theory, are we talking about subtraction, or are we talking about division of this infinite potential?
I think, and this goes back to a little bit of Kabbalah, and I know just a little bit of Kabbalah, perhaps enough to be dangerous, but in Kabbalah it's said that the creation event involved some kind of a creation of a void within this infinite consciousness. And again, don't ask me what kind of void that is, because we're not talking about a space-time void. We're talking about some kind of a metaphysical void. But a void was created that kind of set the stage for a creation to take place. And then there was an inflow of, and they talk about light, an inflow of light, an inflow of consciousness, an inflow of energy into this void. And as a result of that, worlds came into existence. The ultimate world, of course, not ultimate perhaps, but the one we're familiar with is the world of this universe coming into existence through that act of consciously creating a void within itself to make room, to make a stage for something to happen, for something to occur. And I think that something was the Big Bang.
Interesting. And this Big Bang, where all the energy that it took to create all the matter in the universe entered our universe, or expanded our universe into the state of its, you know, beginning of its creation, in a million years, and I guess there's no measure of time, because everything was now at that moment, right?
It was. We can say how long ago the event happened from our perspective today, 13.7 billion years ago. We know that. But what happened prior to that, that's the question, because in a sense there is no prior to that. If time itself came along with the Big Bang, then prior to that has no meaning in the sense of time, yet I think it has a meaning in the sense of causation. So again, we have to kind of say we're faced with a great mystery here, one that is beyond our ability to deal with rationally, because we're just used to working in a realm of space and time. We can't even think in any way that's meaningful outside of the space-time environment.
Well, I understand you. Some of our listeners, though, although they may have read that the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years, they don't really know how we derive that. Can you help us understand that?
Well, it's most easily derived from the expansion of the universe. If you run this backwards, we know how the universe is expanding now. If you run it backwards, you can see that everything would come together into a point, basically, 13.7 billion years ago. We also know how stars age. And there are stars that go back almost to the beginning of the universe, perhaps to within the first billion years. So we know how, and also we know how galaxies, to some extent we know how galaxies are formed and how old they are. So we have evidence both from the expansion of the universe by running that backwards, from the ages of stars, the ages of clusters of stars, the ages of galaxies. They all kind of converge on around 13.7 billion years ago. So that's a pretty well-established number.
Are there regions of our universe that are beyond our sight? In other words, are there galaxies heading so quickly away from us that we will never see their light?
Oh, very likely, because we know from special relativity that you can't travel through space faster than the speed of light. And that's fine, no problem with that. But that doesn't say anything about the expansion of space itself. Relativity theory does not preclude the expansion of space being at any speed whatsoever. So we have a Hubble horizon, which tells us how far away something can be that would still be able to reach us with its light that we can eventually see. That Hubble horizon is effectively the edge of the universe as far as we're concerned. But there may be a vast amount of universe beyond that. In fact, there could be even an infinite universe beyond that. We would never see it because the light would never be able to sort of swim upstream against the outflow of the universe that's happening with the cosmic expansion. So yes, it's quite possible that there's a whole vast universe out there that we will never, ever see because it's upstream from where the flow is carrying it.
Interesting. One of our listeners is asking, is there a portion of the universe or a body of light in the universe that we can't see now that will possibly show up at 2012?
I think it's a bit of a loaded question because I can see the 2012 issue coming up here. It's true that there, at the very edge of the Hubble horizon, there are still, well, let me think about this for a second here. There is still some inflow of light that will make it over time. We are not seeing as far out into the universe as we will eventually. The Hubble horizon is steadily growing, but that still means that there is, for all we know, a vast amount of universe out there that we'll never see or won't see for a trillion years, and we don't even think our universe will get to be that old. Now, as for 2012, I have a suspicion that the listener may have something in mind that's much closer to home that has to do with some mythology about what might happen in that year, which I have great skepticism about.
Yeah, as do I, but it's at least it's healthy and hopefully remains scientific. So according to your theory, creation by subtraction involves subtraction from infinite potential, and I guess I don't want to get into a whole lot of physical terms because it'll get beyond even what I know, but if that's possible, of course, the Hamiltonian of the universe, where we have the potential and kinetic energy added to one another, that makes up the sum of the whole universe. But outside the universe, looking in, the Hamiltonian is zero, so we're subtracting from infinite potential to create what it is that we see. So, according to your theory, we God, or this immense intelligence, divided itself into all the consciousnesses that we see in the universe. Is that what you're saying?
Indeed, it is. It is. The analogy I made was with white light. If you take white light and run it through a prism, you'll find that what emerges are all the colors of the rainbow, because white light contains them all. And you can use those colors of the rainbow to make images, you know, in the old-fashioned sense now of a slide projector. You have a white light bulb that illuminates a slide. A slide filters the colors in just the right way to give you an image. And so that image is created not by some kind of magical thing that just emerges out of nowhere. It comes from subtraction. You subtracted the white light from the bulb in just the right way using a slide to create an image. And I see that as kind of a metaphor for what God did in creating a universe. I don't think he just pulled a universe out of his divine hat, like a rabbit out of a hat, but rather he subtracted. He sort of, out of his infinite ability, out of his infinite self, he created a space in which only some fraction of his potential, and I keep saying his, and I don't really mean his because God has no gender, but just for convenience, that out of that infinite potential and infinite existence, he essentially made a space for himself, a space in which to operate, a space which would become a universe, and took away basically everything except some small fraction of his potential, some small fraction of the ideas that would together make a set of laws of nature that would lead to a desirable universe. And that's what I think creation is about, not something out of nothing, but taking some fraction of everything that will work together to create something that is coherent.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense and feels right. I don't want to make any statements about what God is or isn't, but I guess what I mean that is, if God was everything all in one, and now he is a number of, let's say, souls or particles or spirits or frequencies, whatever you want to call it, that make up a population of beings that collectively are God, are they all the same size and age, or are they each individuals?
Well, of course, we're all each individuals. We all each have our own life history, our birth, our death. Different species have different levels of ability. I mean, the consciousness that God experiences through my pet turtle, Pogo, is a lot less than what he experiences through me. At least I'm hoping so.
Right.
And so I think that the purpose of it all is to experience what physical existence is all about, not just to know it theoretically, but to experience it. And I think that was the purpose behind the creation of the universe. I keep coming back to that, and I think that's the simplest explanation for why a God, an intelligence, would do such a thing as make a universe happen through a Big Bang.
So this experiential creation through which God is, shall we say, he's taking in information or he's experiencing his existence, this is what makes it interesting for us. This is what gives us purpose if we are only conscious, right? I mean, it's not to say that we're not conscious or that all living things are not conscious, but there's certainly something to be said for the idea that there are individuals who are not conscious, they're conscious, right?
Well, I think we all suffer from that a great deal, because here's the thing. I think that in order to experience physical reality in a way that is full and rich, you can't be burdened with too much knowledge. I mean, I happen to believe that we don't live just one life. In fact, it seems rather silly in a 14 billion year old universe for a consciousness to embody just one time on one planet and one being and say, well, that's it. You know, live my 70, 80 years on Earth and that's it. So I believe that if this scenario that I'm proposing is true, that we all live many lives. But, and what that means is that, God experiences through us all sorts of possibilities. Yet, if we come into this life remembering full well what we've done before, we don't really have the freedom to start afresh, to create something new and different and unique. We'd be very burdened, perhaps, with our past. And so I think it's necessary to come into this life in a forgetful way, to have forgotten who we are, where we came from, that we are actually sparks of God, that we may have lived other lives. All these things are forgotten for a purpose. That is, let us come into a life fresh and to do things that are not just dictated by the past we may have had.
Well, some would say that might be a process that's somewhat broken, that it is quite possible to at least recover some of the lessons or some of the wisdom from previous lifetimes, albeit not every experience as a pure memory, but certainly our personality, our capabilities, our propensities, and even abhorrences stick around from lifetime to lifetime, because it just makes sense that we would evolve as God evolves.
Well, in fact, look at a Mozart. I mean, how did Mozart wind up being able to write a symphony at age 7? I think this was not his first life as a musician. It's pretty evident that he came into this life with some abilities that he had acquired sometime previously. It's a much simpler explanation than assuming that, well, it's just the simplest possible explanation I can think of.
Well, someone asked me the question a while back, who built the pyramids, and I really didn't think about it much at that time, but over the years I've continued to think about it, and I realize it was probably us. We built the pyramids so that we would end up here with something unexplainable, impossible, in our own backyards to stimulate us to realize that maybe they weren't primitive after all, and maybe we should start thinking about why that was put in place and what we're supposed to remember this time around.
Well, I wouldn't really know what to comment on that, because I really haven't ever looked into the pyramids as any kind of an anomalous issue. I mean, I'm assuming the pyramids were built by Egyptian labor. But I've never looked into it very carefully.
Okay. Well, I was using it as an analogy that somehow, even for ourselves, we leave a paperclip or we leave a post-it note so that when we come around this time, we can sort of pick up where we left off. As I said, astronomy takes more than one lifetime to really contemplate because it's just too huge to get in one career, I think. I have to drop everything else and do nothing but astronomy just to appreciate it.
Well, I certainly can't even keep up with everything. I mean, it is impossible in any given field to be an expert in the whole field. It's just out of the question anymore.
It's true. I'm still learning to do radio, so not that I ever gave up being an engineer, and my plant is 100 feet away, and the other 6.5 days a week, that's where I am. So help us understand what the absolute is.
Well, you ask tough questions. What is the absolute? Well, I think the absolute is this intelligence. I think if you go to the sacred scriptures, the core teachings at the basis of the world religions as summarized in the perennial philosophy, the discussion has to do with the Godhead. This has several names. In the Western tradition, you would call the absolute the Godhead. In the Hindu tradition, it would be Brahman. Ein Sof in the Kabbalistic tradition, Deus Ex Conditus in the Christian one. And the discussion there has to do with this intelligence being such that we can't really comprehend what it is in itself, that it is simultaneously greater than infinity and less than zero, that it has no properties that we can name and yet has all the properties we could ever think of. It's a complete beyond our imagination anomaly. And this intelligence then, for some reason, decides to create a set of worlds, perhaps, in which to experience its potential. And to do so, it kind of turns a face towards that creation possibility, and that is the sort of the manifest God. In a sense, you have an infinite intelligence that has no time or space or any kind of desire or anything that we can name, that yet decides to create and sort of manifest as a creator God, which is what we would call, I suppose, in Christianity, God the Father, to make something happen. It's not a separate God. It's sort of a manifestation, a role that the Godhead plays to become a creator. And that creator then is responsible for making a universe or universes happen. So that's my view of the absolute. It's something that I can't understand in any way except in the most basic kind of intellectual approach. I don't really understand what it means emotionally. I don't understand what it means in any kind of detail.
Well, I guess that's why we listen to Mozart over and over again, because to contemplate that beauty, that symphony of sounds and harmonics and complexities and rhythms that are in it, takes a different listen each time. And when we look at the world religions that have considered that question and the approach by which they wrote about it, it's profound. It moves me. I mean, it's inspirational beyond description. And I guess you probably feel the same way. I'm a little perturbed by the idea that we have to fight about it. It just seems like we should be able to consider it in a much better way. So when we consider the words in the Kabbalistic creation, let there be light, are we saying there was no light and then light appeared? Or are there, as you said, different lights that are intended in the writing?
I think it's different lights, but the idea is that in this realm of the absolute, this intelligence created a space within itself within which creation was possible, at least creation of the physical universe as we know it, perhaps other worlds as well that we don't yet recognize in the science and that are alluded to in the sacred traditions, that this happened, and this happened through an inflow of what they say is light. They may be referring to energy or maybe something that's completely outside of the domain of physics as we know it today, but it was this inflow of something or other that then somehow gave rise to a world or a set of worlds, as they put it.
Well, I know, at least mathematically, when you're trying to consider what caused the Big Bang, there was an idea that it was a Higgs event, some Velcro thing hanging on and created a potential energy, and when it snapped, it was the micro-energy that caused everything to go. And others would say that, you know, it was sort of like a cell phone call. The right small signal came in, which got constructively interfered with in singularity, and that caused it to explode. But regardless of that, there had to be some, you know, cause for this, all this matter, all this energy in one small space, or even a portal from another universe to open and things to come in. One of my listeners is Alex, and he says, according to my research, God is an organized intelligence from some other universe, thus making him an uncreated being in this universe, and ambient intelligence is, or the consciousness of this universe, is what he uses to create everything that exists.
Well, I don't see that as very appealing as an idea, because if this God that he's talking about is a God that subservient or subordinate to some other universe, then who needs a God? I mean, I think if you're going to invoke a God, it better be a God that is the first cause of everything. Mm. Otherwise, you still wind up with an infinite regress. Now, if you wanted to say that the universe originated in some kind of a quantum fluctuation, well, that requires quantum laws to pre-exist, because you can't have a fluctuation without a law. And so at some point, you have to assume something simply is. It is beyond space. It is beyond time. It simply is. It has no cause. It is an uncaused cause. And to me, that uncaused cause most likely is an intelligence. If that intelligence were something that originated from another universe, then what caused that universe? Let's just back all the way up and see what God created that one. We have to get back to something that is the uncaused cause.
Well, eventually you're gonna reach some Planck level where you cross zero and start coming up again. it's kind of hard to get to that point. I mean, we can fathom as human beings no end, because hey, we always wake up the next day. But when you start going back and saying there's no beginning, that always boggles us, because when we get to the wall, we always want to look over and see what's there. So how deep do we need to go into the metaphysical world before we begin finding the causes for the physical world?
Well, I think a good place to start is the perennial philosophy. In 1945, Aldous Huxley published a book by that name called The Perennial Philosophy. It was his attempt to gather up from all the world's religious traditions some of the fundamental insights into the nature of creation, the nature of God, the nature of mankind. And he found that there are remarkable similarities when you go beneath the surface. Now, of course, we know that on the surface, religions are not very good at agreeing with each other. In fact, they are terrible at agreeing with each other. So it's not likely to find some kind of a commonality there. But deep inside, in the core of the religions, Aldous Huxley, at least, though he did not do this as an original piece of research, it was actually Gottfried Leibniz, and then someone else prior to that, whom I can't remember at the moment, that wrote about this hundreds of years ago. But Aldous Huxley nicely summarized it, and I think that's one place we can begin to look metaphysically. Another place is in the what I consider to be valid evidence of the aspects of this other non-physical reality that may be more fundamental than our physical universe. And that is in the experiences of people that have the transcendent experience. There are many people, perhaps thousands of people, but perhaps even millions if you go back throughout history, many people that have had this experience of oneness, of a universal consciousness, of a oneness with God, where things were all of a sudden crystal clear in such a way that, unfortunately, they couldn't convey back into words because the words don't exist to explain the concepts. And so I think it's possible to actually experience the absolute, to experience the existence of God in the universe, to experience our true nature in these episodes. Unfortunately, I've never had one myself.
Well, yeah, I too understand that. I often say on this program that we are human beings are actually biological transducers, and whatever intelligence is inside of us interprets the universe through this set of transducers that we pack around with us in various shapes and sizes and abilities. And that is a very limited view of the universe. However, occasionally, and one of my favorite teachers recalls an event that she had, that she bounced out, call it an out-of-body experience, call it whatever you want, but for about 4 minutes, she went out and knew everything that there was, and resolved that when she came back, she was going to try to tell everybody everything was going to be okay, that she'd been there, she'd seen everything. And, of course, when she got back, she couldn't say a thing about it. It was very articulate. But the idea was that she had that experience. She was shown, like, the library of everything. And I haven't had that experience myself either, but certainly have had experiences that myself as a scientist, my concentration was instrumental analysis, so it was completely at odds with, you know, what I normally report in a lab notebook. I made this measurement with the biological transducer, so is that observation legitimate or not?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think that it is possible to know it all, although it's not possible, I think, to make that happen. Unfortunately, it's something that seems to happen spontaneously, and in fact, I think it's not even possible to train for it. I mean, you probably have the view, people have the view that if you go to an ashram or someplace and spend years and years meditating, you might be able to bring it about. And perhaps that's true, but I've also heard from one mystic that had the experience spontaneously. In fact, he was a mathematician and one who had this experience, that he felt strongly that this has happened. There's no training for it. There's no preparation. It's just something that can happen.
Right.
And there was, in fact, an interesting book written, again, by Aldous Huxley called The Doors of Perception. And in it, he recounts how in the mid-1950s, he had a mescaline experience. He deliberately took mescaline, and for 12 hours, under the watchful eye of his companions, he tried to very carefully observe what the world looked like with this very different perspective he was engaged in. And he found, as do the people with the transcendent experiences, that there was an aspect to it that he couldn't bring back with him, that was not possible to express in words. And his view was that the role of the mescaline was to, in effect, crack a filter in the brain. I mean, I'm speaking metaphorically. Crack a filter in the brain that is there to usually filter out 99.99 whatever percent of reality that's there. That, in fact, what we're doing as human beings is filtering out a great reality to let us live in this limited world using or according to the rules and regulations and the customs of this very limited perspective that we exist in. And that the role of the drug was to break that filter so that he saw something that usually is really there, but it's not accessible to us. And I think, in fact, there's some evidence for that also from the abilities of autistic savants who can do the most amazing things, and yet who also, most of them, have a certain amount of brain damage. And yet they can do things that are absolutely amazing, such as playing a piano concerto after once having listened to it, even without benefit of ever having a lesson. And that's something that an autistic savant named, I'm trying to find his name right now, Leslie Lemke.
Oh, yeah.
Krauskis Piano Concerto No. 1 after one listen, never having had a piano lesson. Now, this is something I would say, this is impossible. It can't be done. And yet it was. And it indicates to me that this Leslie Lemke may have been tapping into a universal sea of consciousness that permits everything. And he did so because his brain, sort of like Aldous Huxley's on mescaline, had a bit of a crack in it that allowed the what we usually filter out to filter in.
Now, he was blind, too, right? He couldn't see, but he heard it.
Now that I don't know. I don't know about that. Could be. That would be even more so mysterious.
Wow, very interesting. By the way, I have been remiss. My listeners in Phoenix on KFNX 1100, we are talking right through the breaks at the quarter hour and half hour. That's because we are an internet format. So we apologize that we're not able to take four breaks per hour. So you're getting commercials when the rest of the listeners are not. And I apologize for that. We'll try to tighten up the format at a later date. But suffice it to say, at the top of the hour, we will take a break and let you listen to commercials and let our listeners go to the fridge or change files, because many of them listen to the archives. So we appreciate you in the Phoenix market, and we will address you here in just a moment. Our phone lines are going to be open in the next hour, and you can go ahead and write this down. I'll tell you again in the next hour as well. Toll-free 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And if you've got a cell phone, free nights and weekends, unlimited long distance, if you're on planet, off planet, doesn't matter. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. 530-776-5154. That's 530-776-5154. 5 form. My guest tonight is Bernard Haish. His book is The God Theory. His website is thegodtheory.com. We have about 6 minutes left in this hour, and then we will take about a 5 or 6 minute break and let our guests get a drink of water, and we'll come back and go to the next level. This is a 3 hour program. You in the Phoenix market are only getting 2 hours. If you want to get the third hour, you know who to call. KFNX 1100. Tell them you want the third hour of X Squared Radio. So I want to get back on, as we finish up this hour, we were talking about the brain as a filter. I used to consider the brain as kind of a lens, and we were able to focus on different things. And what led me to that was not really the savants, but more how two people can observe exactly the same event and yet see different things. It was like they were focusing on different aspects of the same event. So is it possible that we can look at the brain as a lens instead of a filter?
Well, I suppose so. I thought the idea of a filter was pretty good because it implies that you're blocking out a lot, whereas a lens simply refocuses things. So I kind
right.
of like the idea of the blocking out because I think that the way that the infinite becomes, the infinite is able to function in something that's not definitely not infinite, which is ourselves, is by blocking out most everything that is extraneous to what's required to live in this sort of very limited physical environment that we find ourselves in as human beings on planet Earth.
Huh, interesting. So are we able to improve the filter, or like the savants, are we born with the abilities and we just have to marvel at those that have them?
Well, I certainly hope we can improve it because I think, frankly, that if we don't as a human race do this, not just a handful of people, but overall, that the world itself or the population of the world overall changes its perspective, we're in deep trouble because we're at the point now where the human actions on the planet are becoming dangerous, and unless we have a change in our values and our consciousness, I'm afraid that we're in for a serious, serious disaster planet-wide. So I don't know whether it's going to happen or not, but my feeling is that it had better happen because I think we need it desperately to keep from disaster.
Well, I like you, and I think a lot of people feel this way, that perhaps even this race on this planet has been at this precipice before and not made the right decision, and hence we had to start over rubbing two sticks together for fire and work our way back to where we are now. And maybe, just maybe, this time we'll get it, because we have authors like Bernard Haish out there stimulating our thought processes, coming up with these great questions. So, you know, the savant thing fascinates me, because it's not just the ability to listen to or mimic, but it's also the ability to understand complex processes. I think I recall one gentleman, he might have been in the UK, who saw numbers as sort of an evolving shape or a color or a texture and could recite pi out to 20-something thousand digits.
Yeah, that was Daniel Tammet.
Right, right.
He was able to, he could not tell left from right. They can multiply two numbers together while talking to you, like 377 times 795 while talking to you. He visualized the numbers by shapes. That's how it came to him. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. And he recited the value of pi to 22,514 decimal places. Isn't that amazing?
That's far enough in order. I'm sure that we have no repeating decimals after that, but yeah, it is amazing because, you know, I have to break out the calculator or mentally, even quickly, do the calculation and carry the one and, you know, drop the zero down and all of that. But that's not the way math worked for him. It was a different kind of process. And I also recall the letters of Chandrasekhar that he wrote to several mathematicians around the world. He had pure formulas come to him in dreams, and he sent them to mathematicians who... most of them just threw them away, but one mathematician in England got the letter, actually threw it away, and then that day had a problem he couldn't resolve, and as it turned out, that formula was the answer. So they went down and found this gentleman, brought him up to the UK, and started teaching him and learning from him, because he'd never had a formal math class, but he had tuberculosis and died 2 years later, so we really don't have the finish of his gift. But this was a mathematician who said that he had whole formulas come to him in the form of dreams that we still use today.
Amazing.
So, I mean, it's clear from the examples you have in your book and the ones we've talked already in the first hour that there is more to the existence of, shall we call it, the soul, and thus the collective consciousness of God, than one lifetime, or shall I say, the lifetime we currently are living on this planet could possibly give us. And I agree with you, at least, well, on several levels, that we get more than one chance at this, and that perhaps we are here and come here with accumulated experience, although we can't resolve the exact experience, and that maybe, just maybe, there's a purpose in us being here. Do you feel that way?
Yes, I do. I think that the cumulative experience involves karma. I think that's the point of this concept that you run across mainly in the East, but really I think it's a universal one. I think every action we do has a consequence. That consequence may be good or bad, and that consequence may or may not happen in this lifetime, but I think everything has consequences, because in a sense I think that everything that happens is governed by laws that are kind of analogous to the laws of physics. We have conservation of this and that, for example, conservation of charge. Before or after a chemical reaction, you have the same charge before or after. And I think there's a conservation of something or other that is involved in karma. And that's why I think that one of the reasons that we forget what we are and what we were and where we came from when we come into this life is to be able to undo our karma. If we've done things in a previous life, for example, let's assume that we were, you know, a greedy tycoon who was concerned solely with amassing billions of dollars and didn't give a hoot about, you know, everybody else. Well, maybe that person needs to come back for a life or two and live a very impoverished life and not know why, because otherwise he would be doing it strictly to make up for something that he had done badly instead of learning a lesson, which is what you do if you do something for the right reasons.
Mm.
But I think there's a karma involved here that is kind of analogous to a conservation law in physics.
Interesting. Hope my two college kids learned that lesson long before that. Mm-hmm. All right, that's the end of our first hour here on X Squared Radio. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more of Bernard Haish. This is X Squared Radio, first hour in the can. We'll talk to you in about 4.5 minutes. Don't go away. Rain. Welcome back, Earth Explorers. Don't go away. I'm going to play a little short clip for you. This is one of and just an example of what you could hear on X Squared Radio. We're waiting for our Phoenix listeners to come back in. This was an interview we had a short while ago with Andy Basciago. I think you're going to find it pretty amazing. Here we go.
...that were classified as secret during the time that I served in Project Pegasus as a child, and that remain secret today. The two leading technologies were a teleportation technology that was derived from the papers that Nikola Tesla left after his death in 1943 that allowed an individual to jump through an energy field and travel through a vortal tunnel in time-space and reach some other location in real time on the planet. And during the years that I was involved in Project Pegasus as a child, they had developed the ability to set the teleporter device so that they could set somebody forward or backward in time.
Now you're talking about sending a living whole person through time through some kind of quantum access portal?
Correct. They were opening up vortal tunnels in time-space, and we were traveling through time-space to distant locations on the surface of the Earth. Initially, between a teleporter located at the old Curtis Wright facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds, which were being used as a sort of collection area. But let me say before we talk about the teleportation device at great length, another significant part of Project Pegasus were chronovisors that emerged in the work of two Vatican musicologists, Ernetti and Gemelli, who, while studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants, were developing a specialized microphone, and one day in their laboratory, something that Gemelli's father had said to him when he was a child came through the microphone, and Ernetti and Gemelli sought out the most distinguished Italian scientist of that time, which was the great Enrico Fermi, and by 1952 they had developed that technology into a device that they called the chronovisor, which was a device that propagated essentially holograms of past and future events. And so when I was brought into Pegasus as a child, as a seven-year-old, going on eight in the fall of 1969, they were involving us in project activities involving both of those technologies.
All right, so there you go. That's a typical clip of what you're going to hear on X Squared Radio. We'll be back in about 35, 40 seconds with our guest, Bernard Haish. Don't go away. More of X Squared Radio coming right after this. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWindow forecast, it's about 175 degrees outside. Light breeze. By the way, the space shuttle with the International Space Station attached is going to go overhead tonight. About 10:30 Phoenix time, if you want to run outside and have a look at it, if you're on Mountain Standard Time. After the program, for those of you who still don't believe man ever landed on the moon, the proof is in. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, has returned its first imagery of the Apollo moon landing sites. The pictures that you can find on by going to just about any news service out there show the Apollo mission's lunar module descent stages sitting on the moon's surface as long shadows from a low sun angle make the module's location evident. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera, or LROC, was able to image 5 of the 6 Apollo sites, with the remaining Apollo 12 site expected to be photographed in the coming weeks. Quote, not only do these images reveal the great accomplishments of Apollo, they also show us that lunar exploration continues, said LRO project scientist Richard Vondrak of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Launched on June 18th, LRO carries 7 scientific instruments, all of which are currently undergoing calibration and testing prior to the spacecraft reaching its primary mission orbit. The LROC instrument is made up of 3 cameras, 2 high-resolution narrow-angle cameras, and 1 lower-resolution wide-angle camera. LRO will be directed into its primary mission orbit in August. It's a nearly circular orbit, about 31 miles above the lunar surface. For those of you that have any doubt of what a high-resolution camera can do, we have a camera sitting at about 220 miles up that can read your license plate through air. So 30 miles up through virtually no atmosphere, we should be able to get some pretty crisp pictures of what's on the surface of the moon. Maybe, just maybe, we'll find something other than what we left behind. Our guest tonight is Bernard Haish. His book is The God Theory. His website is thegodtheory.com. And we're talking about creation and God tonight from the perspective of a scientist priest whose journey will continue to enrich us for many years. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back. And by the way, I'm not a priest. I dropped out of that profession when I was 19 years old, but I was dreaming of becoming a priest when I was growing up.
Former priest, now scientist.
Well, I never made it to the priesthood. No, just a seminarian.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, the study.
The study for the priesthood, yes.
That's good, because it gives you perspective. I mean, you're not coming into science totally, devoid of a spiritual background, and you're not forgetting all of that training. You're merely putting it into perspective, maybe.
Right, right.
Well, we have awakened into a physical universe full of matter and energy. So, like would-be watchmakers, we continually try to discover how the universe was made by hammering the watch into pieces. What have we discovered so far?
Well, interestingly, the thing we're discovering in the last 10 or 20 years is that the properties of the universe are amazingly just right for life to evolve. There are at least 10 different laws of nature or conditions of the universe that, so far as we know, could have been radically different, and if they were different, we wouldn't be here. And that's one of the big motivations for my writing this book, that I think that the explanation for why these, and we could talk about them at any length you want, why these laws of nature or conditions of the universe are as they are, that's a big issue in astrophysics. There are books on this that try to explain it in terms of probability and string theory and so on, and that's legitimate, it could well be, but in my opinion, these coincidences, this fine-tuning of the universe, that's no longer debated, really, it's accepted, this fine-tuning of the universe implies to me that there's an intelligence behind it, that it's fine-tuned because intelligence made those laws of nature happen for a purpose. And that's the most exciting aspect, I think, of the most profound insight we're getting into the possible connection between science and spirituality coming from the latest scientific measurements.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, don't forget, especially our friends in the Phoenix market, if you want to call in, our phone lines are now open. The number toll-free, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And if you're on cell phone, driving around, you're on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-776-5154. 530-776-5154. So let's talk about some of the conditions, some of the unique things that if they weren't so, neither our sun, the earth, and us would be here. How about the idea that, let's see, I read about a little while ago, the probability that we would be a carbon and oxygen-based universe?
Well, let's talk about the whole set of them. We can just run through them quickly as a laundry list and discuss them in any length you want.
Sure.
There's the ratio of the electrical to the gravitational force. That's very critical. It could have been very different than what it is. The strength of the nuclear force that lets stars shine. And if that force were 10 or 20% different, either stronger or weaker, we wouldn't have stars shining in a universe. We wouldn't have planets with habitable environments around those stars. There's the amount of matter density in the universe, the ratio of the dark matter to the ordinary matter, the strength of the dark energy. If that were much stronger than it is, the universe would be basically blown apart instead of being a place filled with stars and galaxies. There's a clumpiness that the universe began with. If it had been much more clumpy, then we would have a universe full of black holes instead of stars. If it were less clumpy, we'd have a universe with no structure at all. Again, no planets, no stars. There's a carbon resonance that allows carbon to be formed in the interiors of stars. And carbon, of course, is the basis of life. There is some unusual properties of water. Water is less dense as it freezes, which is rather important, because if that weren't the case, we might well have the oceans freezing over from the bottom up as the ice sank to the bottom. But, of course, ice floats on top, as you know from your martini. The proton to neutron mass ratio. If the protons were a little bit heavier than the neutrons, instead of the other way around, we wouldn't have stable atoms. And then there's the ratio of matter to antimatter. So all these things could have been very different than they actually are. And if they were different, we wouldn't be here. And so that becomes a question. Well, why are they as they are? And there are two ways to look at that. One is to say, well, okay, this implies that there must be lots of other universes in which these conditions are very different. And, of course, we're here because we couldn't be somewhere else. And that's legitimate. And that's the point you'll see made in books by people like Sir Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, and Leonard Susskind, the Stanford physics professor who was responsible in part for developing string theory. But I think an equally logical explanation is that these properties are the way they are because there's a purpose behind the universe. It doesn't make sense for this intelligence to create a universe that's sterile. And so it will create one in which the laws of nature are right and conducive to life. And by the way, that's very important because this implies that evolution is necessary. In my view, the objective of the creator requires evolution. And so it's a very good connection between science as embodied in Darwinian evolution and spirituality.
Well, all of this great publication, all this great thinking, especially in recent years, what is this doing? And I love this term in your book. You call it fundamentalist scientism. How is it reacting?
Well, I don't know how it's reacting because I'm not sure it's noted within science that that's what's occurring. Science thinks of itself as science. I shouldn't really talk about it in third person because I myself am a scientist. I've worked for many years doing research and publishing in first-rate journals and so on. But the problem is that if you take science as a worldview that is unchallengeable, as one that can't possibly be wrong in any way, then you've transitioned from believing in science to becoming a believer in scientism. And scientism, in that sense, is no different than Catholicism or Protestantism or Islam or any other religion. It's a belief system. And I think that there are lots of scientists who, unfortunately, can't even conceive of what I'm talking about. They would say, well, God, we've proven God is an outmoded mythology. End of story. That's it. That view I would regard as scientism because it's no longer looking at things objectively, no longer looking at things and considering possibilities. It's a belief system in what the elements of the universe must be and what they cannot possibly be, and that's a belief system.
Well, sure, but there are all kinds of innovative ideas, and you just mentioned a few, that may fall on deaf ears or at least fall on, you know, ears of resistance in the world of scientism. It's almost a religiosity of science. You know, there are a set of high priests and there's a protocol and a judgment of peers that you have to go before in order to get your ideas legitimized before they can be considered or canonized.
That's very true, and I think that that's unfortunate that science is not as open as it could be. And I understand some of the rationale because there's, frankly, a lot of nonsense in the world, a lot of nonsense out there, a lot of nonsense on the Internet, and if you open the door to all of that and say, well, we will consider all of these things, you know, in due course, you could spend your entire career doing nothing useful. So I understand why science has to be selective in what it chooses to investigate. But to not even recognize that some aspects of the scientific worldview have crossed from being a likely interpretation of reality to being one that's now regarded as the only possible interpretation, that crosses the border between a practice as a scientist and becoming a believer in a religious system a religious system that has no leaders and no churches, but that is religious nonetheless, and it's called scientism.
Yeah, that's interesting, that there is only one universe and we're in it. One of the things that I realize when people talk about this, and it's difficult to avoid the esotericism, and that is that, the universe is meticulously put together. The Earth is a certain distance from the sun, and the moon is a certain distance from the Earth, just in the right place so that we can see the corona the way it is, and on and on and on, and the fascinations of the educated and uneducated abound. The question is that by design, or is it by chance that this occurred the way that it did? And we can consider it. Yeah, go ahead.
I would say that the fact that the moon is just the right size and distance to cause an eclipse, that's probably by chance. I see no divine plan in that, because I think that would take me over into intelligent design, which I don't want to approach.
Sure.
But those constants of nature, the laws of nature, the conditions of the universe that I just enumerated, those 10, those I think are legitimate. Those are legitimate questions to ask. Why are these in their ranges that they are? Why do these have the values that they do that happen to be conducive to life, when they could really be very different? And I think that issue is not really disputed anymore. I think it's accepted that this is a problem worthy of scientific consideration. The only issue is, which side are you going to come down on? Come down on the side that this implies a statistical solution, or one that implies a solution involving an intelligence who thought that the universe ought to come into existence to fulfill a purpose, and therefore these laws of nature have the right values to let that purpose be fulfilled?
Well, let's talk about the carbon resonance. We have stars that create carbon deep in their core and issue it into the universe, and that ends up being the peas and carrots that keep us alive. What about this carbon resonance? How narrow is it? Is it something that can occur in a wide range of conditions, or only a certain set?
Well, it's actually a property of the beryllium atom itself. In the deep interiors of stars, massive stars especially, you have reactions that will lead to the formation of carbon. But the problem is that to get to carbon, you need to combine helium with the beryllium. Helium plus beryllium go into carbon 12. Now, the problem is that beryllium 8 is very unstable, and so it doesn't last very long, and so it's very difficult to get a reaction to take place, or it would be, except for the fact that there's a resonance energy that makes it very likely, much more likely than it would otherwise, for this helium plus beryllium reaction to take place. So if that resonance weren't there, the reaction would be very rare. You'd have no carbon, or very little carbon being formed. And that the problem then would be that you don't have the basis for organic life, because all organic life is based on carbon. So that resonance is a purely fortuitous kind of thing. And in fact, I think it was Fred Hoyle that first pointed this out, and he was rather impressed by that. And he actually wrote in one of the last things he published that he thought that the universe was an obvious fix. And by that I mean an obviously, I'll use the term engineered, but I really mean just an obviously created something that was there for a purpose. It wasn't just an accident. An obvious fix, in other words.
So this resonance, is this, denote a constructive interference that occurs just right so that carbon can form, or?
Well, you have collisions of these two atoms with each other, and
right.
You have a cross-section that then defines how likely it is that there will be scattering, or there will be absorption of one by the other, leading to the formation of a carbon nucleus. And it just happens that with the right energy, this reaction is likely to take place, and you wouldn't have expected that, except for the fact that this resonance exists. So it's purely an atomic physics property that allows the reaction to happen, in spite of the fact that the beryllium 8 is really eager to decay.
Well, I mean, the argument could be made that is by design, and the other argument could be just as you mentioned earlier, that there is an infinite number of kinds of universes, and only this kind of universe could form if there was that kind of resonance that existed. So I was kind of working the logic backwards. Now, you state in your book, without a doubt, the physiological effects of chemicals and genes can affect your state of mind and your apparent abilities, close quote. Now, you know, I'm aware that proteins that run the body are produced by genes, but that there are not enough genes to account for the number of proteins. So therefore, the genes evidently can make a variety of proteins. That apparently is a function of environment, which has been observed to include one's consciousness. So can we discuss the effect of our state of mind with reference to our consciousness?
Well, in the book, I was making a simpler point, as I recall, just that if we really are manifestations of God with access to this great consciousness, why do we have this great diversity of abilities among people? We have geniuses and we have idiots. Why is that? And I think this has to do with the matter of the physiology of the brain and the fact that we are born with a vast array of diversity from one individual to another, and that affects how consciousness is able to act. I think that consciousness is something that's separate from the brain, but it has to act through the brain because we are, after all, physical beings.
Mm.
And so if this brain is subject to certain limitations, then the consciousness that needs to use the brain to function, to live as a life form, is also going to be limited. And I think that was the only point I was making on that particular subject.
Well, I know, but you also made mention that at least others, if not you, were thinking about the idea that consciousness makes matter.
That's my view, that we're going down the wrong path when we try to understand how consciousness can emerge from matter as an emergent property. That, of course, is the perspective that's being pursued in the neurosciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately we're going to discover that we've got it backwards, that it was consciousness that created the universe itself in the form of the Big Bang, in the form of that being a decision, a mental decision in the mind of a creator, and then of all the laws of nature and the stuff that makes up the universe being part of that conscious creation event, I think makes consciousness the seed of all that as well. In fact, it was Sir James Jeans, who was one of the most prominent astrophysicists of the last century, who wrote that he thought that the universe began to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. And that's my view as well, that we're looking at a universe that's usually perceived as being a physical process or a great machine in the view of modern science. And yet I think it's a manifestation of a great thought, that great thought being the thought of a creator.
Well, let's just assume for a moment that that thought has already taken place, and now there are new thoughts taking place, ours, and we're sometimes thinking unconsciously, and sometimes we're thinking consciously. Do you think that we are, at least in some sense, participating in the creation with our consciousness?
Very good question. I suspect, I would say in principle, yes. In practice, probably very little, because if we each were able to take what we want and use our consciousness to create it, think of what kind of a chaotic world we would have. It's bad enough, given our limited abilities to make things happen. It's bad enough in the world today. And think of what it would be like if everybody could imagine what they wanted and have it happen. So I think we do have this consciousness because I think we are part of the Creator, and we can't not have it, because if the Creator has it and we're part of the Creator, then we also have it. But it's very restricted. It's very limited. It's sort of like the mental filter we were talking about in the last hour, that without that filter, we probably couldn't survive in a real world because we'd be off in la-la land. In the same way, I think that the ability to create is real, and I think that that's part of the teaching system, that if you want to live a good life or an abundant life, you visualize it, you visualize what you want, and so on. I think there's some merit to that, but it's very limited because it has to be. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to have 6 billion people on the one planet all co-surviving.
Well, there is total agreement that it's limited, but I think we also realize, just looking at the empirical data, shall we say, that of the 6.5 billion people on the Earth, not many have mastered that ability. They might be inadvertently creating the chaos, but I think you're absolutely right. Very, very few beings have figured out how to, shall we say, manifest using their consciousness. That is evident, but my question is more qualitative. Is it possible that we can master our consciousness to the point where we are participating in the creation?
Well, I think we are participating in the creation within our own daily lives. Now, can we manifest something that has an effect beyond the Earth? I don't think so. Perhaps there are alien civilizations that are much more developed consciously than we are that can actually do things like that. But certainly the human being is not able to do that. And again, thankfully so, because it would be probably a source of chaos rather than a source of order.
Sure. I'm just thinking back of some ancient teachers who said that we had the ability to do what they do and more. And at least in my childhood rearing, that being, and I'm just talking about Jesus, for instance, he was pretty much able to do whatever he wanted to do. He just didn't want to do much except that what he did. But he said that we could do what he did and more. And I take from that that we have inside of us, just like these savants do, amazing abilities. But as you say, it is filtered out. But I guess the conclusion I'm trying to draw here is that we may be born a certain way, but can we awaken and thus turn on abilities that ostensibly were filtered out at birth and now they're not filtered?
Yes, I think we can. I'm glad you brought up that quote, because at the end of my book I do make that quote, and I make it because I want to make it clear that I'm not opposed to, for example, Christianity, but that Jesus himself said, you can do these things, you too can do, and greater things still. The implication to me is, well, we too can become as great as Jesus, because we are really, as it was Jesus, nothing but God made manifest. And so I'm not in any sense putting down Jesus or Christianity, but simply pointing out that he himself said that we can do greater things still. Therefore, we are all with the ability of God to some extent. And that was my attempt to sort of demonstrate that I had no animosity towards Christianity. In fact, I regard myself culturally as a Christian.
Well, I totally understand that, and it really doesn't matter, you know, for our listeners what tradition to which you adhere, but there is a difference, there's a change, a mighty change, one might say, that occurs with the individual when they awaken and realize that they're conscious. Their ability to create changes. Instead of spectating in the world, they begin to participate in the world. And that energy is, those two energies are quite different from one another. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would say that the people that have transcendent experiences certainly find that their lives are changed, their belief systems are changed afterwards, and I think they probably find themselves with a much more fulfilling life. But they can't go out and work miracles, of course. And so it's not transformative in that sense.
Well, what is a miracle?
Well, a miracle would be changing water into wine, for example, to take a biblical example.
In a shorter process than fermentation, I take it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So when we're talking about the entropy of the universe, we talked in our first hour a lot about the Big Bang, and one might draw, they might make the premise that before the Big Bang, matter was very organized in one small place, and then after the Big Bang, entropy became maximized. But then doesn't that mean that out of entropy, out of total chaos, things resonated and became more orderly?
Well, I would take issue with what you said at the outset, which is that prior to the Big Bang, we had matter in some kind of state. I don't think that's the case. I think the Big Bang came together with the creation of the matter that accompanied it, the energy that went into it, and the space and time in which it occurs. I think all these things happened, and they were caused to happen. And it's not as if this was an event that happened in some pre-existing environment with some pre-existing material. The Big Bang was the creation of all the stuff all at once. So I don't see it as a reorganization or restructuring of anything that's pre-existing.
Okay. All right. So before the Big Bang, there really was nothing.
Nothing in the sense of a physical universe, yes.
I got you. But, of course, everything was there. It just wasn't existing yet.
Well, everything was there, I would say, as a thought in the mind of an intelligence, not in the sense of an actualized world, not in the sense of an actualized environment.
Okay, I understand. I understand the word actualized. Some of our listeners get bombarded with the term quantum this, quantum leap, and they don't really. I mean, it's an intimidative term to throw out. What is a quantum force?
I just want to comment on the quantum leap. It's kind of ironic, because a quantum leap would be a tiny one. some people talk about quantum isn't quantum math. They usually mean something large, whereas in fact, by using the word quantum, it's implying something very small. So a quantum leap is a tiny, tiny, tiny leap. But your question was about the quantum vacuum?
Yeah, what is a quantum fluctuation?
Well, it's a very specific thing. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us that we can't ever take the last little bit of energy away from anything. If you have a pendulum swinging back and forth, a regular ordinary household pendulum will eventually come to rest because of frictional forces. But a quantum pendulum will never come to rest because it's subject to quantum laws. And the Heisenberg uncertainty principle forbids taking away the last little bit of energy. And so a quantum oscillator would oscillate forever. And that's not in doubt. I mean, that's a fundamental aspect of quantum physics. Now, when you seek to apply quantum laws to light, to the radiation field, to electromagnetic waves, you find that the same rule applies. You can't take the last little bit of energy away from any specific mode of the field. Let me define what I mean by that. A mode of the field is a direction in which a light ray would propagate and a frequency and a polarization state. And there are many, many infinite number of frequencies and directions and polarization states. And the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that each one of those states, each one of those modes, has to have a minimum energy that you can't take away. And that minimum energy is the zero-point energy. And so that's a tiny, tiny bit of energy per mode, per state of the field, but it becomes huge when you look at the number of modes that the field has. And so it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that creates this fluctuating magnetic field, that's electromagnetic field, that's called the electromagnetic quantum vacuum, or also the zero-point field. It's a quantum fluctuation that sort of underlies the entire universe. It's something we don't directly perceive, but we can certainly measure it with instruments.
Well, now this zero point, this field that is shall we call it, the container that holds all of these vacuum fluctuations, we are talking about a very, very tiny amount of energy for each one of these fluctuations, but almost an infinite number of these fluctuations, right?
That's the problem. At any given point in space, there's no good, rational, defensible reason to cut off these fluctuations at any given frequency. And so for all we know, the frequencies stretch off to infinity. Now, infinity is not something that you like to deal with in science. And so you can argue, well, let's cut this off someplace else. And there is a cutoff called the Planck frequency that makes some sense, but no one really knows where these fluctuations cut off. And so in principle, they could be infinite at every point in space. And that's an uncomfortable thing to deal with. Yet that's sort of what pops out of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle almost right away.
Well, in the world of energy, I don't know if we can call them scientists, we'll call them explorers, are making the claim that there is an unlimited source of energy in the zero point, and all we need to do is stretch out a wire to it, and we're going to be able to power ourselves without burning oil or generating electricity or anything else. But we are talking about very, very small amounts of energy that, aren't enough to light a light bulb unless you put them in series, right?
Well, I don't know. I've got to be cautious about this because there's so much nonsense out there, so many wild claims, so many devices that claim, send in your $199, we will send you a device that will let you run your car on water because you're tapping the zero-point field. It's just the world is full of this stuff now. And unfortunately, that's kind of poisoned the whole field because I think there is a possibility of perhaps tapping into this. And I say that because a year ago, a colleague of mine at the University of Colorado and I obtained a patent to do that. Now, we don't know whether what we propose in the patent is actually going to work. We have physics behind it. There are good reasons in stochastic electrodynamics to think that what we proposed would actually be able to tap the zero-point field to some extent. But we don't know that for certain. And so it's not something I was expecting to come up in this broadcast because it's not really part of the God theory. But I'm not going to discount the possibility that this could be a source of energy. But with the caveat that what you're finding out there now as claimed devices, don't put your money down.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And I do hear all that, too. As you can imagine, on this program, we get all kinds of that stuff. But you did mention SED in your book, Stochastic Electrodynamics.
Right.
And I got to admit, right off, I'm not an expert at this, but as I understand stochastic, it means that all the particles are the same size. You just change the number of particles to change your force.
No, stochastic refers to the fact that it has the same spectrum as the quantum fluctuations, which are random. So what stochastic electrodynamics does is to say, look, let's forget about quantum physics for the moment. Let's assume we have simply classical physics as we know it. But let's do one thing, one addition to classical physics, and that is to add to it a fluctuating field, composed of electromagnetic waves. And that fluctuating field then provides quantum-like fluctuations. And so the question is, can certain quantum properties, certain quantum behavior, be replicated by using simply classical physics plus this fluctuating field? And the answer is, in some cases, yes. You can even derive the black body spectrum that way. Now, one of the implications also of this approach is that if you modify the fluctuations, you may modify electron orbitals. And that comes about because it was shown some 20 years ago that if you look at the hydrogen atom classically and assume that, as was thought 100 years ago, you have something equivalent to an electron zooming around a nucleus, which, of course, quantum mechanics has superseded. But if you look back at that old view of things, and you ask, well, okay, the electron would then emit a certain amount of radiation, which would force it to spiral into the nucleus, which is not a good thing. But on the other hand, using the approach of stochastic electrodynamics, you can show that it would also pick up energy from this background sea of fluctuations. And it turns out that there's a balance in the case of hydrogen exactly at the Bohr orbit. And that suggests that maybe electron orbitals are influenced by the zero-point field. Mm. If that's the case, then you can use Casimir cavities to try to modify that field and affect electron orbitals, which could maybe, just maybe, be a source of energy, and that's the basis of the patent. But I don't want to get into it in any more detail than that, because at this point we simply don't know whether it's a great idea that's going to work or one that's not going to work.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about Casimir, but I also recall another, at least observation, where electron orbitals are manipulated, and that's with ceramic magnets. You know, once you get them down to a certain temperature, the orbitals line up and it goes magnetic, because these Cooper pairs of electrons form flux lines.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually changes state and actually works and does work. Of course,
right,
the problem
is
you run out of liquid nitrogen eventually. That's the problem.
Yeah.
You state in your book that the vacuum of space is actually a seething sea of particles, energy fluctuations, and force perturbations popping in and out of existence, close quote. And I've talked to several physicists up at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory that totally agree with that. So it doesn't sound like a void at all out there, but a perfect breeding ground for creation. I guess people would ask, is there a cook in the kitchen, or is it all just random chaos out there?
Right. I mean, there's no doubt that the vacuum is not a vacuum at all, because you have the electromagnetic fluctuations, then you have the creation of particle pairs, because this is something that Dirac came up with 75 years ago. And so there's no doubt in physics that the vacuum is full of energy and full of particles. The question is any of that stuff tappable? Is any of that stuff capable of being transformed from virtual to real? And that's where the skepticism comes from in terms of the possibility of extracting any energy from the vacuum. And I think we may have come up with a way to indirectly do that using the approach in the patent. But again, it remains to be seen.
Well, interesting. I can't wait to look back from the future at this point and say, I knew the guy that came up with that patent that allowed this kind of energy that we use today. All right, let's see if we can scratch the surface of Casimir. First of all, what is the Casimir force?
Well, it's a force between two parallel conducting surfaces. It turns out that you can modify some of this quantum fluctuation by having appropriate what are called boundary conditions in physics. So electromagnetic fluctuations are affected by the surface against which they act. So if you have two parallel plates, then waves which represent the electromagnetic fluctuations, waves that are longer then the separation between the two plates are excluded from the region between the plates. And this means that you've effectively got less zero-point energy between the two plates than you have outside. That gives you effectively an overpressure. And so it's as if the external zero-point field is pressing against these two plates, and the resistance from the energy between the plates is less than it would be ordinarily because you've excluded some of the modes, and so the plates are forced together. And that's not in doubt. I mean, that's now well known. In fact, it's part of microelectromechanical structure technology as a problem to solve. It's a problem called stiction. Things stick together because of this. But it may also be a useful way to control microstructures. And so the Casimir force is something that's no longer just part of theoretical physics. It's part of experimental electronics.
Sure, sure. I mean, the idea now is to come up with surfaces flat enough so that you can, you know, get them close enough and capture as much of the Casimir force as you possibly can. But I know one thing that happens if you get surfaces too flat, especially with metals, is they start sharing electrons and you can't get the darn things apart. I've actually had it happen with gauge blocks before. Left
right,
to get
the Casimir force is an interesting force, but it's not useful for doing anything.
Well, that's what they say. I mean, the fact that these plates are sticking together and they're not magnetic, let's say they're made of copper, and it takes work to get them apart, then you should be able to resist the force of collapsing and capture that energy. But, of course, it's not been done yet. But
well, you can do that, but it's not in a useful way. It was shown in 1984 in a paper that was published by Bob Forward that a Casimir battery could be built, in which you have these two parallel plates that are kept apart by an electrostatic force, and then you weaken the electrostatic force ever so slightly, and the Casimir force will then predominate and force them together. What you've done is to use this situation to convert some of the Casimir energy, or the zero-point energy, into electrostatic energy, and that's true. That would work, except the fact is that you can't use this usefully because you'd have to pull the plates apart again to have the cycle repeat. It's just like having having an engine that has half a cycle, that's all the usefulness that it has, and that's not very useful.
Yeah, having only the power stroke in a V8 isn't going to help you.
One power stroke and that's it. It's not going to get you very far.
Right, no compression, no exhaust, no intake. You're exactly right, and I don't know if it will ever be practically used because you got the Casimir resistance now. You have to push those plates back apart. So how many plates would it actually take to get a usable force? If you were going to get one event, then you're just drawing all these plates together and you're going to get one compressive event, something measurable would take, what, a mile of plates?
I really don't know.
Interesting. I think about crazy stuff on this program sometimes. So how large is this sea of energy? What kind of potential are we talking about here?
Well, as far as physical extent, it's everywhere. The quantum fluctuations and the pair production takes place everywhere in the universe, inside of us, outside of us, everywhere. Now, in terms of how large, if you mean by how much energy, that's what I was alluding to earlier, that we don't know where the spectrum cuts off. So let me back up for a second.
Okay.
The zero-point energy has a spectrum. The spectrum turns out to be a frequency cube spectrum. And by the way, now I'm going to say something a little technical that, you know, if there's any scientist out there listening to this, they'll catch it, and the rest may not. But the point is that it's a pure Rayleigh-Jean spectrum, which means it's like an infinite temperature spectrum. But anyway, we don't know where in frequency the spectrum cuts off. There's no really solid reason to know that it cuts off here or there. And we assume it may be at the Planck frequency, but we don't know that for certain. So it could, in fact, be an infinite spectrum. That's, as I said earlier, not something that science likes to deal with. But for all we know, it's an infinite spectrum at every point in space, although more likely it may cut off at the Planck frequency, which still would give you something like 10 to the 110 joules per cc everywhere in the universe, which is a crazy number.
And that's a lot of energy.
And yet, you know, this comes straight out of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So something's wrong. Something is wrong somewhere.
Well, some would say, okay, 5.5-6% of our universe is visible and the rest of it is dark. Is it really dark matter and dark energy, or could it be just so light we can't see it?
Well, the dark is not referring to the color at all. The dark simply refers to unknown. We could call it unknown matter, unknown energy. And that's really what it is. And the funny thing is that no one ever thought that we would have dark energy because it's the opposite of dark matter. Dark energy is anti-gravitational. I mean, basically, the universe has an underlying anti-gravity pushing the Hubble expansion faster and faster. That's something no one pictured 10 years ago, or at least 12 years ago before it was discovered. So that's quite a mystery, and it's called dark energy because it's such a mystery.
Well, I think we need a tank full of that stuff so that we can experiment with it. I like your colleague's statement that the average number of readers of scientific papers is 0.6.
That's for the better papers, too.
I found that the success of scientific innovation is directly proportional to one's ability to present the idea. So even very complex ideas presented by the right person can get listened to, a la Einstein. He was a great presenter, and his colleagues were not. By the way, those of you listening in the Phoenix area, KFNX 1100, you're about to leave us in about 9 minutes. This is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to let your affiliate know, and we'll add the third hour of X Squared Radio next week. On this program, we're going to have one of the authors, Don Schmidt, to the book Witness to Roswell. For those of you that think this is all woo-woo and crazy, these people have done a very methodical, very almost legalistic, piece by piece of hard evidence, observations, interviews, and collections of evidence, and made a pretty compelling case that at least something happened in Roswell. If you're interested in that event, tune in next week here at X Squared Radio, 5 p.m. Pacific, for Don Schmidt, Witness to Roswell. We have more coming to you in August. Very exciting stuff. We don't want you to miss a bit of it. We'll be here for 13 weeks in the Phoenix market. So if you have missed tonight's program, the first hour, or the second hour, or if you're going to miss the third hour, which you all are going to do, you can go to xsquaredradio.com and listen to the last hour, or you can call the station and have them pick up the third hour. Not that I'm trying to solicit or anything, but I am. Bernard, one of the things with your paper, you opened the door for science to consider that matter might be manipulated by consciousness. And that's something that really excites a lot of people, scientists and non-scientists alike, one way or the other. Either it excites their ire or it excites their curiosity. What kind of experiments can there be that would prove that this theory holds weight?
Now, this takes me outside of the domain of the God theory because it's not something I discuss directly in the book. But the experiments that have been done over the last 30 years at what was formerly the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory have, I think, pretty definitively shown that there's a very, very small, a tiny effect that consciousness has on the generation of random numbers and even the generation of random processes that involve physical objects, like rolling of not rolling of dice, but the little marbles in a mechanical case. And by the way, their results were actually cited by Carl Sagan when he listed three things that he thought were probably not going to pan out, but that he thought still warranted legitimate scientific investigation. He mentioned the work of the Pear Lab, and what they've shown is over several million tests that the concentration of the mind on random numbers can skew the distributions one way or the other. And that, I think, is the most quantitative assessment that's ever been made of the possibility that the human mind, its consciousness, can affect matter. And I think it's very open-minded of Carl Sagan to actually write about that, even though he said he didn't think that it would pan out, but to say it was worthy of investigation.
Well, I know after Carl Sagan, there was a set of experiments done by Bill Tiller on the changing the pH of various solutions, growth rates of bacteria, things like that, by just using human consciousness. So interesting stuff, and I don't know if we're going to see much come out of it, but as you say, it is a curiosity. And I know changing the pH of a solution just by concentration, that's certainly quantifiable. So let's just say they did it. I mean, the ramifications for humans is at least today, that you know, they could change the pH of their own bodies, they could change the pH of various solutions, change the salinity of water. That makes us more of a participant than the average, shall we call it, spectator.
Well, even the effects on our own health. I mean, I think there are lots of examples of people who apparently spontaneously, have cured themselves of various diseases and so on. And I think it's certainly widely believed among people that are spiritual and religious that we do have the ability to influence our own bodies in positive and negative ways. And so I think probably that's where the most practical application of some of this might is occurring and will continue to perhaps grow in the future.
Right, and even pooling those intentions and manifestation abilities together as a group or as a population on one thing or another can certainly make a difference.
Right.
One of the things that I found fascinating about your book is you consider light in the sense of a proton. And I want to, maybe you can help us understand the life cycle of a proton. Where does it start?
I don't quite follow the question because light is not a proton. What is
in a photon.
A photon. Well, the interesting thing about a photon is that it travels, of course, at the speed of light. By definition, it travels at the speed of light. Now, if we look up at the night sky, say, and look at the constellation Andromeda, it's 2 million light years away. And so we say, well, I'm looking at something that happened 2 million years ago. What happened was that light from a photon from some star in Andromeda got emitted. It's heading in my direction, travels 2 million light years through space, 2 million years through time, and makes its way to my telescope, my eye, or my binoculars, and boom, it's absorbed. That's our perspective, and that's correct from our perspective. But from the perspective of that photon, it jumped instantaneously from where it was emitted in some star in that galaxy to where it was absorbed in our human eye instantaneously.
Uh-huh.
Because it experiences no space and no time. Because the Lorentz transformations of special relativity say that time has dilated to zero and the distance has shrunk to zero. And so that photon jumps instantaneously from point A to point B, no matter how far away those points are from each other. Now this opens the question, if that photon jumped instantaneously to our eye from the Andromeda galaxy, would it have jumped if it had no place to go? Because it has to be absorbed somewhere. And wherever it's absorbed, the passage of time from its perspective is zero. So it's a really interesting question. It's kind of both a philosophical and a scientific one, whether the photon could be emitted if it did not have a place to be absorbed.
Well, isn't it a little like Einstein's frustrated comment about his disbelief that the moon existed just because a mouse looked at it?
Well, the moon's a little different. I think the moon tends to stay there. But the question is valid for a photon because the photon does instantaneously make that transition. And so could it have made that transition if it had no place to go? My suspicion is it couldn't. In fact, you may even be able to test this scientifically. You might be able to shoot off a laser beam in various directions in space, and in certain directions that photon may not ever encounter any matter to absorb it before it would hit the Hubble horizon. So maybe some difference in the drain of the emission or the drain of energy that's causing emission of laser light in a certain direction, the change in that from direction to direction might be able to indicate whether or not there's this requirement that the photon has to have some place to land before it can leave. So it could be actually a physics question, not just a metaphysical one.
Well, I like it. I mean, I told you my background's instrumental analysis, and I'm just racking my brain trying to think of a way to actually measure the drain on a laser. Once you turn it on, it's, you know, sending photons out into space, whether it travels forever in the void or whether it strikes a star or even the eye of a...
Well, I'm talking about changing the direction. Look, move the laser beam around and see whether under the same condition, under the same power conditions, the drain changes as a function of where you point it. Because there may be no place in the line of sight for that photon to go in certain directions. This is a very vague physics experiment, but one that fascinates me.
That is interesting. That's an interesting challenge. You might try to figure out a way to do that. So this photon, I mean, it carries information. It carries data about that star, whether it's rotating, whether it's traveling away from us or toward us. Is there a reasonable belief that the purpose of a photon must be known before its creation?
No, I don't see that, because an individual photon doesn't tell you any of those things. It's really just a collection of photons. If you want to know that a star is moving away from us, you have to look at a spectrum. One photon won't do it. So the individual photons don't carry any energy except their own frequency. Each photon has a given frequency. It represents a certain frequency of radiation. So you can't really attribute information to a specific individual photon. It's a collection of photons that provide information, such as, for example, a Doppler shift.
Right. So as photons are traveling out in ostensibly all directions from trillions of sources out there in space, and will continue to do so until they react with some destination, are we saying that none of these photons could leave their point of origin unless they had the realization that they were going to have, well, I see what you're saying, because it's traveling at the speed of light, there is no time that elapses relative to that photon, so therefore it had to have a destination in order
to
have origin.
Yes. That's the idea, yes.
Interesting. Interesting paradox. Well, that's the end of our second hour. We're going to go well beyond your imagination in the next hour, so hang with us. We'll be back in about 4 minutes 33 seconds. Those of you in the Phoenix market, we hate to lose you. We'll see you next week, 5 o'clock Pacific time. Don't go away. We'll be back with more of Bernard Haish after this. Thank you. back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. The temperature has dropped. It's about only 150 degrees outside right now. Don't forget, about 10:30 tonight, 10:26, the space shuttle and the International Space Station will go overhead. Coming from the west, you won't be able to miss it. Look to the south, you'll see Jupiter, and to the west, you will see an amazing white light pass overhead. In October, October 30th through November 1st, the Burlington, in Burlington, Wisconsin, the UFO conference is going to occur. Our friend Mary Sutherland has been up there a long, long time doing great work, and we want you to know if you're planning a trip this fall, October over Halloween through November 1st, that would be a great one to see. Great speaker's going to be up there. A UFO hunter is going to be up there. Don Schmidt, author, co-author of Witness to Roswell, is going to be there, and other great speakers. Nice, beautiful part of the country to go visit. I highly recommend that you get there. If you want to know how to get there, you want to know how to register, go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the Burlington UFO link, and they'll fix you up. Just look for the little animated character down there on the right-hand side. Don't forget to tell them you heard about it here on X Squared Radio. This is a three-hour program. If you're not getting all 3 hours, please get a hold of your affiliate. Let them know you're out there. You want to tune in and get squared. My guest tonight is Bernard Haish. His book, The God Theory, and his website is thegodtheory.com. I love having physicists on the program because their area of focus is so great, and the level of accomplishment that they reach is so high that we're all enlightened and expand because of their experience. And we appreciate you being on the program, Bernard.
Well, thank you.
Question, does light create space-time?
I would say no. In Einstein's theory of relativity, space-time is curved, and it's a curvature of space-time that causes gravity, and it's a curvature of space-time that also causes light, photons, to be deflected from what would be their usual straight-line direction, and that, in fact, is one of the measurements that validated general relativity in 1919, was the deflection of starlight. So I would say no, a light is affected by the space-time curvature, but and light, the presence of light as a source of energy can itself, to some extent, cause space-time curvature, but it's not the overall cause, no.
So as we look up in the night sky and we look at the stars, and we mentioned the space station's coming over, we mentioned you can look out and see Jupiter, and of course there's Arcturus and other very bright stars, Vega, out there that you can see in the night sky. Is there light really coming in a straight line from those stars, 187 light years away, to us, or is it actually following a curved fabric to us?
Well, the fabric is pretty straight. I mean, the fabric, there's very little curvature, in fact, essentially no curvature in interstellar space. The curvature is around objects that have gravity, massive objects like the Earth. The Earth does curve space ever so slightly. The Sun, somewhat more than that. As I said, that was the measurement that confirmed general relativity. But in interstellar space, there's really no curvature to speak of, no. It's essentially a straight line.
One of the things that we're trying to do out there is directly observe the presence of a black hole. I mentioned the LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington. Immense instrument. If you've ever been up there, I'm just breathless when I go up there and look at the history and the work that they've done up there. They're actually trying to directly prove by measurement the existence of a black hole by using this giant 4-kilometer interferometer. It's clear that when light comes to us, it does curve around various objects. I mentioned that there's going to be an eclipse on the 22nd in Shanghai. Tell us about the direct observation that we discovered, or actually proved, Einstein's idea that light is curved around the fabric of space-time.
Well, the idea was that when light travels from a distant star and grazes the sun, or goes around the edge of the sun, the fact that the sun is a massive object and has a certain gravitational field, that will deflect the light just ever so slightly as it passes by the sun. That deflection amounting to something like 1 3/4 of a second of arc. A second of arc is a very small amount. So how would you measure this? Well, that's why you need an eclipse. The idea is that you photograph a star field when the sun is not in that part of the sky, and then you photograph that same part of the sky during a total eclipse of the sun, when the sun is there, but its light is blocked out. So you can still take a photographic plate and get a picture of the stars because the sun is blocked out. And yet the sun is there and will deflect the light. And so the positions of the stars will be slightly shifted between one plate and the other, because the one plate was taken when there was no sun there in the star field, and the other was taken when the sun was there in the middle of the star field, but hidden by the moon so you could take the photograph. And that was done by Eddington in 1919. In fact, Eddington and another team that did their observations in Brazil, and when they took the plates back to England and developed them, they found that indeed the one plate showed a slightly larger shift than Einstein had predicted. The other one, a slightly smaller one, but taken together, they were just about right on, spot on, as you'd say. So that was what was taken as the proof of Einstein's general relativity. And that's literally what made Einstein famous. It was written up in the New York Times in 1919. It was called a great scientific success. It's something that they said only 12 men in the world were capable of understanding. That's what they wrote in their headlines. And so it was that measurement of light that that really made Einstein's theory of relativity one of the pillars of modern science.
See, now, Eddington was another great mind, larger than life, who had the ability of presentation. But he wasn't, you know, all science. Wasn't he kind of a mystic as well?
He was. He's kind of a hero of mine. Eddington is a fantastic guy. He was... A book was written about him by Chandrasekhar, who called it the Eddington, the premier scientist of his age. And he was really at the forefront of astrophysics in the first half of the 20th century. He made Einstein famous by making that measurement of starlight. And then he was the one who wrote the first textbook on general relativity. It was, in fact, that same textbook that years later I myself used as a graduate student. It was a difficult book. It was all tensor calculus. But Eddington was the one who took Einstein's theory of gravity and wrote the first textbook on that. And then only a few years later, he was the one who wrote the first textbook on the internal constitution of the stars. In other words, what was it that made stars shine? He was the one who suggested that stars obtained their energy from nuclear reactions of hydrogen to form helium. And so he was really at the very forefront of astrophysics, and yet he was also somewhat of a mystic. He was a Quaker, and in 1929 he gave a lecture and published a book called Science and the Unseen World, in which he talked about his views that there is more to reality than the physical universe that we can observe with our senses and with our telescopes and so on. And so he had no doubt whatsoever that there was more to reality than physics and or than the physical universe. And that was a profound, I mean, I consider that to be a profound insight on the part of someone who really, really knew his science.
Well, and in those days, we didn't communicate the way we do now. I mean, you know, ideas and papers and that went through very eclectic publications. It wasn't like you could come up with a great profound idea, put it on the internet as a blog and have 10 million people view it in the next 15 minutes. To get to that level of notoriety, you really had to have your stuff. You really had to be peer-reviewed. You had to impress those peers. And you had to almost never be wrong. How did Eddington do it?
Well, of course, that's still somewhat true today. I mean, if you publish a theory on the Internet, along with all the other theories that are out there, it's not going to make any impression. You really do need to have peer-reviewed papers published to get any kind of respect and acceptance by the scientific community. How did Eddington do it? Well, I think just plain hard work and the fact he was a brilliant guy. He was certainly well rewarded for that. He was named president of the Royal Society. He was president of the International Astronomical Union. He was knighted for his work. Now, of course, you're British. That's the ultimate recognition to become a knight. So he was Sir Arthur Eddington. So how he did it, I don't know. I mean, it was just a matter of his brilliance and his hard work. But certainly he was recognized as being an expert in physics and astrophysics. And his writings on philosophy and his writings on the existence of other realms besides the physical received a lot of attention in England early half of the last century, and he was writing at the same time as Sir James Jeans, who was almost as famous as Eddington, who was the one who wrote that he thought that the universe looked more like a great thought than like a great machine. And so together, both of these men, these great astrophysicists writing about things that had to do with spirituality, made a big impression. It kind of legitimated spirituality as something that was not in conflict with science as it was known back then, just as I'm proposing that what I'm suggesting in the God theory in no way contradicts modern science.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it does seem that spirituality contradicts religion, though, and seems to agree with science. I like it myself. I think there's a big difference between religiosity and spirituality.
Oh, is there ever? Yes. I mean, I think that a big problem in the world is the problem of religions. They tend not to agree with each other. They sometimes preach hateful things about each other. They don't tolerate each other so well. Some of them do, some don't. And there's certainly been a lot of evil done in the name of religion. I mean, look at what happened in the Inquisition. And look at what's happening with this insanity in the Middle East today. It's, to me, I think we'd be better off if religion disappeared from the world. But that doesn't mean going over to an atheistic point of view. And I think that the fundamental fact is that we are spiritual beings. We don't need a religion to tell us that. We don't need someone to stand between us and God because God is within each of us already.
Mm.
So I feel very different. I feel that there's a big difference, a huge difference between spirituality and religion.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I just couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the reasons you can't find very many Agnews in the phone book is because we were the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway in Scotland and fell by the dozens to those who wanted to find the secrets to the Templars. You quote in the book, the book called Conversations with God. And I really like this statement. I'll quote it here. It says, "My divine purpose in dividing me was to create sufficient parts of me that I could know myself experientially." So there really isn't anything to be afraid of here, is there?
No, there isn't. And I really like that series of books. Now, I realize that I could be criticized as a scientist for accepting something that sounds like channeling. And the question is, you know, did Neil Donald Walsh, was he talking to God or was he talking to himself? What I say in my book was the answer to that question is yes. Yes, he was talking to himself, and yes, he was talking to God, because I think he was communicating with the God within himself. And so to some extent, he did nothing different than any of us could do ourselves, but he did it in a way that was successful. And I'm impressed not by his claim, but by the words of, quote, God in the book. To me, those are answers to questions, or the answers given to questions are ones I wouldn't have predicted in many cases. So I'm
exactly
struck by the material itself. It's not his claim of the material, it's the material itself that I find to be very compelling. And that's why I quoted at length from his book, with the permission, by the way, of his publisher, Frank DeMarco.
Well, I trust that our discussing it doesn't violate that trust that they placed in you. I'm curious about it. It was a bestseller, and it really does, strike the poignant strings inside of people as they reflect on their own divinity. I guess I have so many questions I could go in many different directions. And I've often stated on this program, as I said, I think in the first hour, that our bodies are really biological transducers through which we, our eternal beings inside of us, interpret our universe, and you concurred that was close to being accurate. And I guess my comment is, in a single lifetime, we arrive at different stages of awareness. I guess we kind of had, like you said, a transcendent experience. Some would call it an ascension experience, where you have this aha moment where, as I often say in mathematics, there is crying in mathematics. When you get to the point where you're crying because you can't get it, you're about to understand it because it's all going to fall together and make sense. So I usually tell my math students, if you haven't started crying yet in your frustrations, you haven't put enough into it to understand it.
Well, that's an interesting perspective.
Well, I will tell you, tensor calculus, when I went through it, the very first thing that I endeavored to do was forget it. Because it caused me so much consternation.
It doesn't really stick with you very well, no.
No, matrix math is not one of those things that you use every day, even in physics. In my area of study, I concentrated on instrumental analysis, and I was fascinated with measuring things. And then in 2006, while minding my own business, eating cookies and drinking milk, I had a very strange experience during meditation that taught me that I could make direct observations of the universe directly, just using my consciousness in meditation. have you, in your explorations, sometimes not sought the textbook, but more sought the solitude of your own concentration to find the answer?
Well, it's hard to say because I'm basically not an overtly experiential person. My wife is, and so I have a compliment here in the house that, you know, sort of shows me what that would be like. But I'm very much involved in the intellectual aspects of things, and my knowledge of, well, whatever truth I've discovered that I've published in the book, The God Theory, has come sort of on the intellectual side, not the experiential side. I haven't had any of those aha moments, although I guess I must have some intuition. Again, my wife says I have a lot more intuition than I give myself credit for. I sort of tend to get ideas in the morning when I wake up, sort of coming out of I don't know where. So I must have some of that, but overtly I don't really have much experiential experience. Kind of wish I did, but my lot in life seems to be to pursue things intellectually. And maybe that's a good perspective to have for this book. Maybe all the experiential books that are out there are plenty, and to have my intellectual take on things is a valuable change of pace.
Well, I do find the arguments, albeit scientific, have spiritual overtones, that you have realized certain truisms in the relationship between those things that we cannot measure, the more experiential things that you were talking about, and the things that you can measure and can quantify. So at least you can admit that.
Yes, I can admit that. Yep.
Well, is it possible that we caused ourselves to forget who we really are?
Well, I think that forgetfulness, that's part of this whole process of incarnating. Because if you have baggage or karma or some lesson you need to learn or something you want to do, if you knew the total background of it and the mistakes you'd made in the past or the things you brought with you that were already, you know, part of your experience, you wouldn't have the opportunity to do something fresh and new. You see, I think the whole point of our coming here and of God's seeking consciousness experiences through us is for novelty, for newness. If God wanted, I assume he could probably make everything happen in a totally perfect way, but that wouldn't be very interesting, even to him, I would guess. And so the idea is to have novel experiences, to let the universe take off and run. That's why evolution is so essential to all this. That's why Darwinian evolution is a key element in making the purpose of the universe come about. And so I think that the role of freedom in doing something, living a life unencumbered by our past experiences, is an essential part of playing this game of life. And that's frustrating because you wonder, why am I here? You know, why did I get into this particular mess, say? And it may be that you've gotten in this particular mess because this complements the mess you've made once before, or something you didn't get through, or something you didn't do right, or could have done better. It's very frustrating not to know why you are here, but I think the forgetting is sort of an essential part of playing the game.
Well, it would seem that there is sort of a tug-of-war between knowing and having faith. You know, having faith, we have to struggle, we have to reach, we have to imagine, we have to contemplate, we have to weigh and experiment. But knowing, you can sort of stand on that, take it to the bank, reach to the next thing, and knowing everything, there's nothing to reach for. But it's kind of an interesting process. So do you see the Creator as a cosmic watchmaker who's kind of put the universe together, wound it up, and he's letting it run? Or do you think he's involved?
Well, yes. I mean, to some extent, the watchmaker is correct if you don't take it too literally, because I think that what the Creator did was to dream up laws of nature and then let those laws of nature conspire to make a universe via the Big Bang, and then to have that universe be such that is conducive to the origin of life on the surfaces of planets. And I think that then the Creator sort of steps aside and lets his consciousness enter into those beings that exist in the universe, but doesn't go tinkering around with them, doesn't go playing games with us from on high. Now, can you actually communicate with God in some useful way to try to create your own reality? I think you can in some way. But I don't think that God reaches down and makes things happen because he is mad at us or because he wants us to behave in a certain kind of way. I don't think that kind of interference would fulfill his purpose, because I think he himself wants to let the novelty, the unplanned, the unexpected, the things arise on their own, and in a sense remove his own omnipotence from the arena so as not to interfere. In fact, that's what theologian John Hutt wrote about in his book. Can't remember the exact title of it now, but it was the idea that God has sort of stepped aside and relinquished his omnipotence and his omniscience within the arena of human life to let us do our thing, unencumbered by outside pressure or influence.
Well, if you continue with your God theory, you realize that God hasn't stepped aside at all, that he is involved in every single one of us because we, collectively, are him.
Indeed, and he's involved with us from the inside. What I'm saying is, I don't think he's involved with us from the outside.
Yeah, I got it. In other words, he's not going to step in and avert some cataclysm or some disease or end some war or cause a war, for that matter.
Indeed.
Because he's going to let it follow the wars and even out the way it's going to even out. So what is the end run of this quest for perfection that we seem to be involved in?
Well, of course, I wish I knew these things. You ask tough questions as if I had the answers. I just try my best.
That's
but
okay.
There was a notion that the Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit paleontologist, had of an omega point for evolution. And he took evolution as a fact, but he added something to it, that it wasn't simply a process of pure randomness and pure mutation that caused the evolution of species and evolution of us as human beings, but that there was something else, something that we haven't quite recognized yet, that was sort of a drawing of the forces behind evolution to some kind of perfection point in the future. And so it was evolution, I'd say evolution plus. And that idea appeals to me, even though he himself was never able to actualize or to come up with some provable process that demonstrated there was more than randomness involved. But I tend to think that there is. And I tend to think that coming to that omega point, I think that was another one of his terms, that the universe evolving to an omega point will make it be sort of the ultimate completion of what it can be. If the universe ultimately becomes the best it could possibly be, at that point perhaps it's time for everything to return to the Creator and for us to say, yes, this episode of creation, this worked just fine. Everything has now been resolved and, you know, we've had a good, light, nice long run of it and we succeeded.
Well, it does mention, I think it is in Revelations chapter 2, where it says you become a pillar of heaven to go no more out. So, you know, maybe you have, everything is resolved mathematically. All the charges have been balanced, and it's time for you to return to ground zero or to the pinnacle or home. Nothing more for you to learn. On the other hand, one could say that, you know, Jesus didn't have anything to learn either. He came here to teach, and maybe that was something that needed to be entered into the record.
Well, I think so. I think it's possible that, in fact, I even think it's likely that there are beings, I shouldn't say beings, but there are humans that are so evolved that they needn't come back to this world of imperfection, but they do because their presence is a teaching presence. And I see the Buddha in that category, I see Jesus in that category, I see others. And so I think it makes sense that there are beings who do come back voluntarily, not for themselves, but to help others.
Exactly. One of the most profound things in your book, you say it toward the end, what we do know, as you put it so profoundly, is we are here, our universe exists, a creation has taken place. I really found that profound. Now, why are we so driven to fill in the pieces in between all these things for the world to know?
Oh, well, I don't see that as a problem. I think that as human beings, we are curious. I think curiosity is, again, probably part of the divine attributes that we share. And so to try to take these different steps and find out what connects them all, I mean, I think that's laudable.
Oh, I agree, but some, you know, wander through life, you know, wondering if they're going to win the lottery or not, and others are awake, and they seem to exist in a sea of, you know, those that are in wonder or asleep, and we live in a constant state of amazement, as the writer of Joe versus the Volcano said. I see a qualitative and quantitative difference in those two beings, one going through life existing from paycheck to paycheck, and the other you know, waiting for the next moment that they're awake so they can absorb more information and figure out why it is that this creation has taken place and what their place in it is.
A very good point, because I think this is part of the, to put it mildly, the challenge that we face today. Perhaps, in fact, it may be critical whether we meet this challenge or not. If the human race continues concerning itself solely with what it can do here and now, how much money can I earn, how can I get ahead, how can I, you know, do something at the expense of someone else, we may be headed for catastrophe. I think that coming to recognition of who we actually are, that we are God manifesting in this physical realm, that knowledge alone could have a profound impact on how we treat each other and how we treat the planet. And I think it may be essential for us to come to some planet-wide realization of that, because at the moment we're so consumed with trivia. I mean, look at how much energy was spent on Michael Jackson in the last few days. I mean, whatever you think of him as a performer, it's not really of any great consequence spiritually, you know, what Michael Jackson was doing in his last days and how he was buried and so on. Yet that's where millions of people focus their attention. And we are living in a world that is basically centered around how we can use distractions to make money, how we can use trivia to divert people from thinking about serious things, how we can get people enslaved to money so that they'll not think about things that take away from our economic and political system. And I think this is something that is challenging us today to come planet-wide to some change in that, or else I think that the consequences may be dire.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you on every point. I mean, just the fact that event, whatever it is, because I don't watch TV, that kept media so tied up with Michael Jackson was more a function of, gee, we better run this or the other networks will, and we'll miss out on listenership, than it was any concern for Michael Jackson, his notoriety, or his family, all entertainment taken into consideration. Be that as it may, there are things that are really, really are affecting our planet and are affecting the universe, not the least of which is global warming, you know, clean sources of energy, social impact of the fact that we've now reached 6.5 billion people, and that is threatening to double, and not in the socioeconomic class that you might think would be able to provide for themselves, but quite the opposite. You're exactly right. There is a lack of awareness that must be reversed, or we as a race are, you know, definitely, I can't say definitely, but there's a high probability of extinction or something close to it if we don't change our course.
Yes, I agree very much. It is very worrisome.
Well, that's why we approach it from so many different angles. You know, I'm in my day job trying to help other industries come along that might have a change on that, and you and yours and your thinkings and writings at least exciting the analytical population to examine, and legitimately so, from a mathematical and scientific point of view, the fact that we are much greater than the sum of our parts.
That's correct, we are, and we have to realize that. If we don't realize that, we will be forever enslaved to the system we've created ourselves, which is one of our system of having to spend our time making a living and serving others, and serving others not in a good sense, but in the sense of just providing more resources and making more money. We could go on and on, but let's end on a more positive note.
Yeah, exactly. Let's try. When you think about things, do you bounce them off your wife, and does she help you with some of the more premonition aspects of your writings?
I do, actually. She's very different than I am. She's a musician. In fact, she's an opera singer. In fact, she's off right now in Verona, Italy, studying opera for the next couple of weeks. So I'm here doing this interview all by myself.
Oh, that's amazing.
but she also has memories of past lives. I have none. I am totally blind to that. But it was some of her stories to me when we first got together that got me thinking along these lines. And to take it more seriously, at the time I just scoffed at it, but as I think about it, it's the only really sensible system that I can think of for justice and a merciful God and a way to resolve the questions of evil and so on. So, yes, I discuss these ideas with her all the time, and her perspective is a very different one and very much more attuned, of course, to the arts than mine, and very much more experiential.
Well, I could say I know exactly what that's like. The fact that you're made it up with a person who is in touch with at least multiple existences that she has had and has, in some sense, brought that experience, if not the lessons from that experience, to this life and sharing it with you. And that is just amazing. More synergies all the time. And, you know, I'm not saying that you're spiritually dense, because you certainly are not. You have insights into what would normally be a very sterile science that are certainly spiritual. And it's not just from your Catholic upbringing, but from your imaginations, the ability to place your contemplation out there in the void and come back with information that's meaningful and have the tool set to explain it is really remarkable.
Well, thank you.
I personally believe there is a purpose for existence, all of them. Does this purpose extend down to the individual?
Well, I think so. I think that if it weren't somehow important to the intelligence that made all of this to have the experiences, to enter into the consciousness of all the living life forms, then it wouldn't have done so. I think that by experiencing all the diversity of life and all the diversity of circumstances that can be had, not just in this species of ours, but not just even on this planet of ours, but, you know, presumably elsewhere in the universe, all these experiences together somehow must enrich the intelligence. Now, I've said before that this intelligence must be the absolute, beyond infinite thing that we can't even comprehend. Now, how can you make something that's already perfect even more perfect? I don't know. It's a mystery. But somehow this must have a purpose, in not just for us individually, but in the grandest scheme of things, for the intelligence itself, to know itself, under all circumstances. I think that there's something really important here for the intelligence itself, or it wouldn't have done this.
Exactly right. I couldn't agree more. And to know itself, that is so powerful. I mean, you can go to thine own self be true, and you can go beyond that and really make a direct observation of population, that the vast majority of people on this earth alive right now do not know themselves. We have a caller on the line there, Bernard. Let's go ahead and take that call. A caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, this is Trace. I'm calling from Salt Lake City.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to call in and thank Dr. Hache for his book. It was one of those that kind of helped me get a better grasp on what the quantum field is. I think, and I'm hoping I'm not mixing this up with something else that I read, but had to do with, you described it as kind of like going into a room where everything was the same color. Everything was white, and so you couldn't distinguish the walls from the furniture because everything was the same color. And the question I had was, we talk about and read about Jesus and his experiences healing the sick and doing all kinds of miracles, and I'm assuming this is the field that he was able to access. Does that make sense?
Well, the context of that statement about the white light in the room has to do with polarity. That was a point I made in this book, and in fact, this goes back to one of the first questions that was asked during the show about the absolute. In the realm of the absolute, and I'm just talking, of course, as if I knew this, I'm no guru, I don't really know these things for certain, but my take on it is that the absolute is something that is literally absolute, but it's not possible to have experience within the absolute, because to experience something, you need polarity. To experience hot, you need cold. To experience light, you need darkness. You can't have one without the other, it's impossible. Therefore, to have experience, you need a realm of polarity, and this universe is a realm of polarity. And that's, in fact, why, unfortunately, we have good and evil, because good and evil is a polar thing. You can't have one without the other. And so it was in that context of trying to explain why this seems to be a realm of polarity as opposed to a realm of the absolute that allowed experience to manifest itself, which would be impossible to have in the realm of the absolute, perfect, blissful, tranquil, everlasting intelligence that I think is the root of it all.
Okay, I look at that and I say, okay, well, if both sides are both sides drawing from this quantum field, both light and dark, and I have to make that distinction, because, you know, it's the only way that we can really tell what's around us and how we're experiencing things. But are both good and evil per se drawing from this quantum field?
No, I would say not. I didn't want to draw the analogy or didn't want to draw a link between this polarity and the quantum field because I don't think that exists. I was talking about polarity as a basic property of existence itself, that you have polarity of everything to experience something. And the quantum field having to do with the zero-point energy of the electromagnetic quantum vacuum, I think that's an interesting topic, and that's something we may be able to tap even, as we discussed earlier. But I don't see anything in it that relates specifically to perception or to polarity.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that, you know, some would say that, you know, for instance, good cannot exist without evil, that there must be opposition in all things, blah, blah, blah. And it's not necessarily so, that it is possible to have all quality and all goodness in the universe. The question is, what is the quality of the goodness? Would you call it evil? Would you call it good? The inference from the book is it's all experience.
Right.
And I think that's what I got from it. Am I right, Bernard?
Yeah, that's correct. I think what the caller was suggesting, though, was that somehow we tap into, quote, the zero-point field for various things that have to do with our nature. And I don't think that. I mean, that's exactly what you find on the web. A lot of people claiming, who unfortunately don't know the physics behind the zero-point field. So I really tend to kind of want to sort of soundly say that the zero-point field is not something that I want to associate with human behavior or consciousness.
Sure.
It's a matter of physics.
Okay, so there's not the interaction there.
Not that I can see, no.
Okay, so I'm looking out at a tree outside my window here. And although we are immersed in the quantum, in this quantum field, it's everywhere. The way, you know, the waves that hit my retina that tell me that that's green and brown and the variety of things. I'm trying to associate my experience being inside that field. And being able to see that tree.
I think you're mixing up two fields. One is the light field that, you know, comes from the sun shining on the tree that then reflects the light back into your eyes, which is fine. Okay. But that's what it is. And this background quantum electromagnetic vacuum field, which has got nothing to do with your perception. And the reason, in fact, I even brought it up in the book, and I kind of wonder whether I should have, but I did, so it's too late now to change it. Was because I published some papers together with colleagues that suggest that the property of mass might be attributed not to a Higgs field, but to the zero-point field. And that's very controversial, even though it was published in some very high-level journals, such as the Physical Review and Annalen der Physik, which is the journal Einstein published in. So I mentioned in the book because I thought that there may be some connection between the property of mass, which is a fundamental property of matter, mm-hmm. and the zero-point field, which could then perhaps point back to these biblical allusions about light being a fundamental aspect of creation. So if quantum light somehow generates mass, then that is sort of a bottom-up look at the creation of the universe itself. It was merely a suggestive kind of speculation that I put in the book, and that was the point of having it in there at all.
Well, I understand, and that part of the book you derived the formula, which is a postulate, which is F is equal to ma, force is equal to mass times acceleration, as a postulate, and then you derived it using the zero point, which I thought was brilliant, and others did too. But don't you think that the community kind of has a wait and see attitude right now. Okay, now you.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
Let's
very much so. In fact, the wait and see has to do with when the Large Hadron Collider at CERN comes back online. It started operation last fall and then had a short circuit that really badly damaged part of the equipment in the tunnel. It's been under repair ever since. But they'll be back online again, and one of the top targets, of course, is the Higgs particle. If they find the Higgs particle, then all right, so much for my theory about the electromagnetic quantum vacuum being involved with mass. Okay, so be it. But if they don't find it, eventually they may get tired of it and decide, well, let's look around if there are any other possibilities. And lo and behold, we have a possibility here. So you're right, it is certainly a wait-and-see thing. A bit frustrating, but it is a wait-and-see thing.
Yeah, by the way, the last magnet was fixed 5 weeks ago, so it's getting ready to go back online probably by the end of this month.
Right, good, good. But it'll take years before they finally decide, well, you know, we've run all the tests we can, we still don't have the dang thing.
Yeah, yeah, hopefully they don't destroy the planet in starting it up, but that's another...
Oh, I know, I'm on somebody's emailing list, and he sends me these nutty, well, I don't know, tirades about how the Earth is going to be destroyed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, creating black holes.
Yes,
all right.
Right. Yeah, right.
Trey, did you get your question answered?
I did. I really appreciate that because it's always been one of those things where I've kind of thought, well, maybe there is an interaction, but I really loved the book.
Thank you very much.
I recommend it to everyone.
Thank you very much.
I did too, and it isn't written way over your head. I really liked it. It was good, not only on a technical standpoint because. You at least have some bibliography there, but you certainly quoted a lot of books that I now have to go buy because I want to know more. But you also played into it the exoteric and esoteric points of view that really make the book poignant, really make you underline it and go back and read it again. I liked it.
Well, good. I'm glad you got your money's worth.
I did. One of the questions that people would ask, and I think Trey was trying to get at it, is the universe purposeful?
I definitely think so. I mean, I think that was one of the fundamental postulates I went into this book with, the idea that I'm going to present the perspective that the universe is the way it is, that these constants of nature, these laws of nature, these conditions of the universe that we talked about, are not just an accident, as they could be. I admit they could be, but I think they're not. And the reason they're not is because we have an intelligence who wanted the universe to arise that it could experience. Could experience through the creatures that live in it, that arise in it through evolution. And so I think 100% that the universe is a purposeful one and that it's fulfilling its purpose through our lives and the lives of all of the living creatures.
I sometimes wish that I could at least... contemplate more or I could see more because here I am on this planet and I'm only going to be here for 100 years or so and we only have so much good instrumentation. There just isn't enough time to contemplate the entire universe, only what light happens to reach this little blue orb. So in that respect, it's frustrating, but in another respect, it's completely fascinating because I don't know if you agree with me or not, but this is an awesome place to have a mortal experience.
Well, I guess it is, and I guess that's why we're here. You know, Sir Arthur Eddington wrote that in his book, Science and the Unseen World, he said that if we could wake up tomorrow and know everything about nature and why and how it works, wouldn't that be any great thing? That would be a great source of disappointment, not to be able to follow the trajectory of discovery. And so he was addressing that very point about... you know, there's a limit to what we can know at any given time. And yet he saw that as something positive, because if we knew it all, that would be the end of the adventure.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's a little bit like having someone come up to you and say, oh, did you see that L.A. Lakers game, double overtime, and they won, and you haven't been home to access your TiVo yet. So another listener has written in, so are coincidences just that?
Well, you know, I tend to think that there are lots of coincidences. Again, this is kind of a point between my wife and I. She's always finding coincidences to be meaningful, and I think most of them are just coincidences. But I think there is such a thing as synchronicities. And, in fact, there was an article published on this in the Journal of Scientific Exploration that I edited about synchronicities in the life of Wolfgang Pauli that he went to discuss with Carl Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And things sometimes just happen that would be viewed as solely chance, that have no causal connection, but yet that somehow are significant. And you're talking about a good friend to somebody, someone you haven't seen in years and years, and along comes a sheet of paper blowing down the sidewalk that has a name on it that happens to be the same last name as the person you're talking about. I mean, and that's not a very good example. It's something I just quickly made up and not all that good. But these sorts of things do happen. These are called synchronicities by Jung. And I think these are probably the ways in which our consciousness and that of others sort of plays in this realm of ours, where we're not allowed to just overtly create things, because that would be, again, a world of chaos, and we could each create our own reality fully. But still, there's a certain amount of creation we can do. Perhaps we send ourselves or each other little messages by synchronicities that happen that are of note. But again, I think most coincidences are just that, coincidences.
Well, they probably are. But then again, synergies are absolutely impossible to deny. When you need a resource and you've never accessed this resource before, and then you walk around the corner and there's the resource laying on a park bench in front of you, that's a little synchronous. It means that...
It is. I think this is part of the way that we create our reality. I agree that those things, those occurrences are real. They're not just accidents.
Right. And it could be that is at least an echo of our creative energy, that somehow we designed to come here, whether we needed to again or not, and somewhere in this life we have little nodes of resonance that resonate with our energy, with the things that we put out years ago or days ago or hours ago, and they then manifest out of that resonation. And that's another show all entirely, but in physics we do see that, because, for instance, in the half-life of nuclides, why doesn't it do it in one whole life? Half of it does it now, and half of it does it again in a whole. And you were talked about fluorine-17 and oxygen-17. That's a natural decay, but why does only half the fluorine-17 decay to oxygen-17, and why does some of it hang on for years and years and years and never decay?
Well, here's an interesting question about that, actually. What tells the atom that time is passing and it's time to go and make a decay? What tells the atom that something is happening, that time is flowing? That's a good question.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the answers was proposed by Sir Richard McCrae, a British astrophysicist who lectured on this when he was awarded the gold medal from the Royal Astronomical Society. He proposed that it was, in fact, the quantum fluctuations that made things happen, that the quantum fluctuations were, in fact, the clock underlying the universe. Well, why does an atom know that, gee, 60 seconds have passed, it's time for me to decay? How does it know that? His suggestion was the quantum fluctuations. And so there may be a very fundamental role that's being played by this zero-point field that has to do with actually driving the dynamics of the universe itself, which would be kind of, a bottom-up look at creation as opposed to the top-down one from the perspective of spirituality, say.
Mm. Well, it's a better answer than most. I mean, when you consider from a physics point of view in the universe, if there is a now, what is the flow of now in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
And
what makes things happen?
Yeah, if the quantum fluctuation is, as you say, the Planck pendulum, maybe that's the timer. But if it is the timer, then why does only half the fluorine decay?
Well, I don't find that so mysterious. The question is, how sensitive is it to the fluctuations? And so,
sure.
The more fundamental question is, what makes time pass at all for something? It's something happening. I think we don't fully understand time at all. I mean, I understand time in the sense of the four-dimensional space-time diagrams that you draw in relativity theory, but there's still something very mysterious about time, about its passage, about what tells fundamental processes that time has passed. We just don't really understand time at all, even though it seems to work pretty well in terms of special relativity, but I think there's a deeper mystery there.
Sure, sure. And time goes to zero when you reach the speed of light. Just look at the equation and you can see the relationship between those things.
Yeah.
Wow. I love this. I would like to have the post-colloquial beer, but...
and time has run out, right?
Exactly right. We have about 2 minutes, well, actually about 1 minute left, and my producer needs to get another host on. Bernard, it's been an absolute pleasure. The book is called The God Theory. The website is thegodtheory.com. Of course, you can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and probably any bookstore out there. I really appreciate you coming on the program and discussing the book. It was a pleasure to read.
Well, thank you very much. It really was a pleasure being here.
All right. And again, the 3 hours goes pretty quickly on this program, so we appreciate you hanging in there, because sometimes times can slow down when we're talking about complex things. But it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
All right, my friends, X Squared Radio, 3 hours every Sunday from 5 to 8 Pacific Time. We are live in the Phoenix market, KFNX 1100, 50,000 watts strong, and we're going to continue to expand that market because you deserve to learn about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Next week, we have Don Schmidt, one of the authors of Witness to Roswell. Don't miss it. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.